new Chicago Sun-Times managing editor, Chris Fusco. Check Please host, Catherine Diorio. And from Henry, Portrait of a Serial Killer, John McNaughton and Michael Rooker. And now here's your host, a man who wants to be on Check Please, his restaurant, The Outback Steakhouse, Justin Kaufman.
Justin says, stay for the 40-ounce Fosters. Go for the 40-ounce Fosters. Stay for the Bloomin' Onion. Welcome to the download, everybody. 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman with you till 11 o'clock tonight. Yeah, I would. There was a time where I was serious about the Outback Steakhouse being my choice for the Check Please. I used to go up to the one on Toohey all the time when I lived in Ravenswood. We would go there, and my wife was so good at stalking tables in the bar area. Because if you go to the front at Outback Steakhouse, it's like it's a 45-minute wait. It's hour 25. And here's a little thing that will beep, you know. But what you would do is you would go and kind of stalk around the bar booths in the area. And she was really good at being very assertive to be like, we're next. Are you getting up? Can I finish that for you? Can I get this credit card to the waitress for you?
That's a good skill. Delicate hovering is really a great skill.
So if I were going to go on Check Please, it would be Outback Steakhouse. And I'd just talk about hovering. Talking about the skill of what it takes to have a great Outback Steakhouse experience. And it really is about hovering, because if you try to get on that main list, because they also when you get in the bar area, they do you want a Foster's? You want a really big Foster's? Yeah, I'd love a really big Foster's and a Bloomin' Onion, and maybe we'll share something else. And you're like, and you feel like you get out of there and you're like, oh, I'm not crazy. When you do the dinner part where you sit down in a booth, the upsell's crazy. Would you like a crazy koala? Would you like a crazy koala lemonade? No, I'm okay. We've got 16 different salads, sirloin. You want shrimp and sirloin. That's what we do in Australia. And you're like, all right, all right. So anyway, I think that would be good. They don't do enough chains on Check Please. Anyway, Catherine Diorio is going to join us tonight. We're going to talk to her about the new season of Check Please, which starts tomorrow. My favorite show, Pete's favorite show. 16th season. Unbelievable. Also, tonight, Michael Rooker's going to be here, John McNaughton. We're going to talk about Henry, Portrait of a Serial Killer, which is celebrating its 30th anniversary. 30 years ago, it made its world premiere at the Chicago International Film Festival. It returns 30 years later to the same festival. It's going to be screened tomorrow at River East 21. McNaughton and Rooker will be in attendance. We'll talk to them about the movie, about making that movie. Michael Rooker, who, Walking Dead, Guardians of the Galaxy, he was a kid straight out of acting school here at DePaul. He was a kid who went to Wells High School. This is his first movie. So we'll talk to him about his first movie being about a psychological thriller about a serial killer. Usually, easy fare. Talk with those guys. Chris Fusco is going to join us as well. Chris, the managing editor at the Chicago Sun-Times, a position that's been vacant for a while. We had Craig Newman on, who was the last managing editor, as his exit interview probably a year ago. It's been a year. Chris Fusco, the great investigative reporter there, award-winning, is moving from that beat to being a manager. We'll talk about what it takes to be a manager of a newsroom, what it also takes to get that paper looking forward in this town, a town which is always seems to be imbalanced or at least on shaky ground when it comes to its media company. So we'll talk, Chris Fusco, about keeping that paper moving forward. Also tonight, Chris Jones is going to come by, talk about some of the commercial theater fare here and why it's struggling. There's a couple of shows that came through Chicago that were, they thought instant hits, Cheers on stage, things like that. And they're closing early. They're jetting out of town because our audiences here in Chicago are not gravitating to those shows. They're not flocking to those shows. So we'll talk about why that is. And Chris Jones will be in the studio. Also talk about the big Goodman Theater musical War Paint getting its date on Broadway today. So we'll talk about that as well. Adam Hoge will talk about the Bears. Let's play the Jaguars on Sunday. Just talking about how that's probably the best time to go see a Bears game.
Are you going?
I'm not. I haven't even decided yet. I made the determination in my head. I'm like, I'll start thinking about it tomorrow. because I want to go. I want to go to a Bears game. And this is, like I said, this is the best time to go. It's October. It's against an AFC North or AFC South team. Nobody cares. The Bears are 1-4. It's Brian Hoyer. You know, some of the stars aren't playing. It's a great time to go to Soldier Field and enjoy at face value or less.
When,
I'm not paying over, man.
When you submit your application for the tickets, or, you know, when you're, are you negotiating with somebody perhaps?
No, not yet, but I will.
I was listening to Tom Skilling because I'm very concerned about the weather this weekend because the Cubs are, you know, are playing at home and there's like thunderstorms in the area. I think Sunday might be there's storms in the area. So I was saying, like, hey, it's supposed to be stormy on Sunday too.
60% off, right? Right off the gate.
Take them off your hands.
I'll take them off your hands so you don't have to go all the way down to Soldier Field. That's my final offer. A lot to do tonight. Koya Paz will be here as well, longtime friend. We'll talk with her about her new show at Free Street Theater. Okay, so much to do tonight. Let's get right to it. News, weather, and traffic with Rob Martier and Esmeralda Leon. Production provided by Pete Zimmerman. I'm Justin Kaufman. This is The Download, a show about Chicago starring those who know it well. All right, we'll take a break. We'll come back and do the carryout. Stay with us. It's Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. We got a great show. Let's get to it tonight. Start with the carryout. This, of course, our nightly segment where I read the news. So you at home, you don't have to. Here are today's top stories. The Cook County budget was proposed today by President Tony Preckwinkle. Among other things, she wants to add an additional tax to sugary drinks. Preckwinkle says this tax isn't necessarily about filling a budget hole, but a health tax to stem off diabetes and other concerns from overconsumption of said drinks. So sugary drinks have become the new cigarettes. I swear, government, if you go after coffee next, or Thai food, or tax on last-minute Christmas shopping, I'll just take it. Also, Cook County commissioners have proposed a 50-cent tax on Uber and Lyft ride-sharing. This would be 50 cents on top of the 52-cent surcharge that the city tax on. So now sugary drinks and ride-sharing. Seriously, this, come up with new tax ideas. Stop taxing the same thing over and over. Here, I got one for you. Tax man-spreading on the train. You spread your legs and block a seat, 50 cents. And that's just me off the top of my head. I'm not a lawmaker. You are. You get paid to do this. Stop taxing the same things. It's ridiculous. Ugh. Rants on the radio, 25 cents. A new Chicago Sun-Times report says that when it comes to complaints against the Chicago police, 130,000-plus complaints, only 500-plus firings. That's roughly 1%. And I'm not talking about the yacht-partying Wells Fargo-type 1%. Settle down. That's a different 1%. You know, whenever 1% is said in the media, a bat signal appears over Bernie Sanders' Vermont house. Somebody talk about the 1%? Gotta get there to the Ben & Jerry's bat cave. Today, Donald Trump threatened to sue the New York Times after they wrote about two women who said they were groped by the Donald. He said that some of the women coming forward were too ugly for him to have groped. And then he said that, you know what? No, I'm done. Pass. You can find it on Facebook. One of your friends posted it. It's just too much. WikiLeaks emails have surrogates in a tizzy over Hillary Clinton's campaign notes, like moving primary days or strategizing on how to handle the email scandal. In other words, politics. I don't know about the WikiLeaks stuff. I thought there'd be more bombshell material. Maybe they're holding it back for next week? Because this stuff that's come out is what you would expect from a political campaign. I understand Donald Trump is just winging it, but this is usually how it's done. What I need more, hey, John, this is Hillary. Listen, I know I'm running for president, but do me a favor and don't tell anyone that I'm actually the devil. And also, I'm going to give a ton of money to my friends. Cool? Also, I'm actually Bill Clinton in a mask. Peace. That's what I want to hear. Also, here's a good news story of note. Wendy's announced that they're looking to move to an automated register in over 60,000 stores nationwide. They're thinking about it for next year. This, in part, is a response to the move to raise the minimum wage. Oh, nice. So you may save money in the long run, Wendy's, but what happens when those robots want to raise? It ain't going to be a strike. It's going to be more like Terminator. So thanks, Wendy's, for getting us closer to robot apocalypse. Dave Thomas is just rolling over in his square patty grave. In weather, it's supposed to get down to 45 tonight. Jeez, time to dust off the old electronic blanket, am I right? You know what I mean? I don't mean anything that's literal, electronic blanket. In sports, we'll know tonight if the Dodgers or Nationals will be the footnote to the Cubs' magical run to the World Series. I hope it's the Nationals, so A, game start earlier, East Coast, and B, Dusty Baker, right? How great would it be that if this playoff run is not just for this year's team, but it's to excise the demons of the past? First, Jeff Samardzija. Second, Dusty Baker. Third, are there any Cubs on the Indians? No? Is Moises Alou coaching in the Blue Jays minor league system? Nobody? Steve Garvey broadcasting games? Nothing? Ugh. Anyway, the Cubs are set to play primetime games on Saturday and Sunday, so if you're planning on hitting up that Taco Bell on Addison anytime this weekend, I'd skip it. Yeah, for a number of reasons, I'd skip it. The Blackhawks are 0-1 after losing 5-2 to the Blues last night. Coach Q wanted to play some of the rookies, but he didn't get much time because the Hawks were so busy playing catch-up. Game 2 is tomorrow night in Nashville. They still have a team? They didn't get rid of that team? They should have got rid of that team. Move them to Vegas or whatever. I hate the Nashville Predators. Somebody has to. I'll do it. 8 months of hating on the Predators. Great. The Bears got some good news with Bryce Callahan returning to practice. If you're wondering who that is, why bother at this point? He's the replacement for cornerback Kyle Fuller. He hurt his hammy after playing well, which is apparently what you do when you play well on the Bears. You get hurt. Also, even though Cutler shed the cast off his thumb, he didn't practice today. They have a Thursday night game next week, so my guess is he won't be back for that. But he will be ready for a QB controversy on Halloween night, which is Monday Night Football against the best defense in the league in the Minnesota Vikings, right? Perfect time for Cutler to come back and fail, right? On the national spotlight, so we can hear John Gruden go, I don't know why this guy is playing. You can just see it, right? Jeez. In college football news, reports out of South Bend say that Coach Brian Kelly has lost his team, and some say it's time to replace the embattled head coach. Kelly responded by getting super red in the face and yelling at an 18-year-old wide receiver because, you know, that's stress relief for him. And finally tonight, Bob Dylan received the Nobel Prize for Literature. When asked how does it feel to win the Nobel, Dylan said, how does it feel? It feels okay. That's the original lyrics of that song. That's the carryout for October 13th, 2016. And it's going to be cold tonight, so we're firing up the soup specials. Sorry the cream of broccoli is so crusty. I mean, it is 5 months old. More to come on the download tonight. Chris Fusco is going to join us, the managing editor of the Chicago Sun-Times. A longtime investigative reporter has moved over to the management side. We'll talk to him about what it takes to be a great newsroom editor. Also, Adam Hoag is going to join us to get us ready for Jacksonville versus Chicago. Grudge match. That's coming up. 720 WGN. Stay with us. Rob Martier, how are you, my man?
I'd love to see a Bloomin' Onion featured on Check, please. Come
right?
on.
Come on. The shots, you know, when they're like playing the jazz music and they're like, take a look at this thing.
You can't beat that. The sizzling shrimp on top of the filet special. This week only, limited time.
If I went on it, the first thing I'd say, you know what I love about the place? It's just there's no rules and it's just right.
Yeah. Your check's in the mail, by the way.
Right, exactly.
Hey, man, I like the Outback.
I do, too, man.
I really do.
I swear to God, that was like our go-to place when I lived in proximity. I probably went there 55 times.
It's like, a safe bet.
Yeah, it is. It was good. After every time, I'd be like, oh, man, that was too much food. Or I don't want to come here anymore. And then like next week, we're like, where do you want to go? I don't know. Let's go to Outback.
Man, that Bloomin' Onion was...
right. Oh, that old fight song. It's 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. The Chicago Bears at home at Soldier Field taking on the Jacksonville Jaguars. What do we know about the Jacksonville Jaguars? Adam Hoag joins us from WGN Radio Sports. You can find out all of his coverage. He covers the Bears. You can get it at WGNradio.com/Bears. His new podcast is up right now, Intentional Grounding. Adam, how are you, my man?
I'm good, Justin.
So I think the only thing I know about the Jacksonville Jaguars is that they are supposedly a high-octane offense, but we haven't really seen that this year.
Yeah, that's because their quarterback, Blake Bortles, has been making mistakes with the football. He's now in his third year, and you know, I still think he has a ton of talent. I believe they selected him third overall a few years ago. And I look, all the talent, but maybe a little Jay Cutler in him. With mistakes at times that you don't want to see, but they do have a pretty impressive offense, especially throwing the football with Allen Robinson. Mark Easley, Alan Hearns, so they can spread you out with, and they just signed Julius Thomas in the offseason too, the tight end. So they have guys they can spread you out with, and with the Bears banged up secondary right now, I think it's a big question mark going into this game is whether or not Bryce Callahan will be healthy, the Bears' kind of emerging young cornerback who suffered a hamstring injury in Indianapolis on Sunday but did return to practice today, albeit in a limited fashion.
He played lights out against the Colts. They seem to be calling his number. The Joe Buck-Troy Aikman combo was calling Callahan's number a lot. I don't know, is that because he played a tremendous game or is that because the Colts were targeting him?
It's probably that they were targeting him a little bit. I thought he played well, though, maybe a little bit more up and down than the week before against the Lions. He was outstanding the whole game. And then I think last week they found ways to pick on him a little bit. Andrew Luck can do that to you. But I think overall he was still pretty solid, and it was when he came out and Jacoby Glenn went in that they got that big touchdown.
Oh, yeah, right.
Yeah, to T.Y. Hilton, that game winner. So they missed, the Bears missed Bryce Callahan when he came out of the game, and they need him back for this one given the weapons that the Jaguars have. And you know, you can point to Blake Bortles and say he turns the ball over, but this Bears defense is still not forcing turnovers.
I was going to ask that. That was something that we talked about post-season last year about how the Bears were just terrible at getting turnovers, interceptions, fumbles, things of that nature. And they really tried to beef up in the offseason to address that. But after the first five games here, the Bears are still deficient in that category.
Yeah, they are, and they have a negative turnover ratio towards the bottom in the league, despite the fact that, you know, I mean, Brian Hoyer hasn't been turning the ball over. So they haven't been committing too many turnovers. They did have that unfortunate fumble by Cam Meredith late in the game last week. But, you know, it's more so that the defense isn't really taking the ball away at all. And that was something they've spent the entire offseason working on, and from a scouting perspective and also as a practice emphasis, teaching more techniques and harping on that in meetings and trying to get these guys to take some chances and make plays on the ball. And, you know, there's been a little bit of an improvement, but not enough. So in a matchup like this where you're almost kind of relying on the opposing quarterback to throw it to you, I just don't like their chances.
Yeah, you just wonder about that because, you remember, there was so much made of Rod Marinelli's defense and even Lovie Smith, the idea that they just preached turnovers. I mean, they you know, woke up and went to bed talking about getting the football and running towards it. And John Gruden would always talk about, look at the practice drills. I mean, how hard is it? Is some of it mental? I mean, these are professional athletes. I mean, you would think that they've been trained from an early age to try to turn the ball over, right?
Well, it's mostly ability. I mean, you got to have the guys who can do it.
Like the Charles Tillmans and such, right?
Right. And then at that point, once you have the guys, then I think it's a mentality because, you know, if you don't concentrate on that in an entire game rep, well, you might be a split second too slow, right? Mm-hmm. So if you have that ability and those ball skills to go make those plays, then that's where, and you get experience and really what it comes down to, not to get too technical, is being able to read your receiver and understand, look for keys in what he's running to be able to break on a route. I mean, if you can understand what your opponent's doing, that gives you the best chance to be where the ball is going to be, right? And I think right now it's a combination of maybe they've upgraded the talent that they have, so the guys that actually have those ball skills compared to last year. But I think these guys are still so young, other than Tracy Porter, who's probably been the guy who's making the most plays on the ball,
right.
Obviously. But these young guys just don't have enough experience yet to really understand, oh, this is what this guy's doing, and break on the ball hard.
All right, let's talk about, we're talking with Adam Hoge here about the Bears as they get ready to take on the Jacksonville Jaguars at Soldier Field on Sunday. Let's talk about the offensive side of the ball, because Brian Hoyer and the Chicago Bears offense once again put up monster numbers, 500 yards plus when it comes to offensive yards. But the bottom line is that their points, the points they're actually putting on the scoreboard are pretty scarce. There doesn't seem to be a sort of, you know, when you think about putting up 500 yards and only scoring 23 points, it doesn't seem like those two things are in sync.
They're not, and the numbers on the season aren't in sync either. Total offense, the Bears are ninth. They're averaging 372 yards per game. Points, they're 30th, only averaging 17. So that gap between being 9th in yards, in offensive yards, what you're piling up from a yardage standpoint, and then being third to last in the entire league in points scored, that's a problem.
Where does that come from? What is that? I mean, is that just having the inexperience to punch it in at the end of drives?
Yeah, I think a lot of it's been self-inflicted wounds. We saw penalties kill a drive last week. But also, you know, I think, look, they got a quarterback in there right now, Brian Hoyer, who's playing very, very well and executing from an efficiency level in that he's not turning the ball over. People, I think I've heard that word efficiency used, and I've probably used it too much the last couple of weeks too, because, if he's being so efficient, he's being so efficient. I look at efficiency like you're also scoring points. I mean, that's got to be part of it too. Right. I mean, how efficient are you if you're piling up all these yards, but you're not really capitalizing in points? And I look, when things tighten up in the red zone, that's where you have to be. If you're being safe, if that's your mentality, well, now you're even being more safe because there's less room to operate, and that's a killer area to commit a turnover, right? So I think there's a little bit of a lack of a killer instinct in the red zone too, just inherently with the quarterback they have out there right now in Brian Hoyer. And, you know, I think part of the reason why Jay Cutler's had so many interceptions in the red zone throughout his career is because he has more of that killer instinct to take shots. So you see that rewarded a lot, but you also see that risk pop up with turnovers. So the opposite effect's going to happen with the safer quarterback, and I think that's what we're seeing. That's why I really, truly believe the Bears win that game on Sunday if Jay Cutler's under center, because at a minimum, he's looking for Alshon Jeffrey on that last play of the game. But also, I think they have way more points to begin with. I mean, I think that game's in the 40s if Jay Cutler's playing.
Adam Hogue, WGN Radio Sports. You can find it at WGNRadio.com/Bears. Last real quick thing, Jay Cutler, the cast comes off, but he's really not ready to play, is he?
No, but I still think it was a good sign to see him out there last couple days without the brace and actually throw the football a little bit, albeit on the side. He's not practicing, so he's not going to be ready this week. Maybe an outside shot for Green Bay next week, but then they have 12 days off before they host the Vikings on Monday Night Football, so maybe that's more realistic.
That's where he's going to make his debut in front of Monday Night Football.
Back-to-back primetime games coming up again.
Got to win this Sunday. All right, Adam, great to have you. Thanks for being here, bud.
All right, thanks, Justin.
This is Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Coffin. Coming up, we are going to talk with Michael Rooker and John McNaughton, Henry, Portrait of a Serial Killer, back at the Chicago International Film Festival 30 years after it debuted its world premiere in 1986. Gentlemen are in town. They're going to be at the screening tomorrow. Talk to them about putting that controversial film together with only $100,000. Let's put that together. Talk about that coming up. Well, just last month, Chicago Sun-Times named longtime investigative reporter Chris Fusco as the new managing editor for both the paper and digital content. Fusco's been with the paper for 16 years, and before that, he's with the Daily Herald and the Northwest Herald. Fusco, a local product, grew up in Alsip, also has written great pieces for the paper. I mean, everything from covering casino licenses to Mayor Daley's nephew and the David Kochman case. But now he moves from tracking down sources to tracking down reporters on Deadline. Chris Fusco is my guest tonight. Chris, good to see you.
Very good.
And,
thanks, Justin.
And congratulations. I'm late. You know, like I feel like this was 3-4 weeks ago. Everyone else said congratulations. I'm a month late, but.
Well, sometimes we're late on Deadline, too. Hopefully the presses keep running.
For you as an investigative reporter, what about being the managing editor appeal to you?
Well, as I told the staff, this is something that's completely out of my comfort zone. And when Jim Kirk approached me with this, you know, one of the things he talked about was temperament. And temperament is something that you build, you know, in the heat of the moment, whether it's having President Obama in the editorial board and having to write a story that you know the world's going to read, you know, in the process of doing that, it's 3:15 in the morning on a Saturday morning. Or whether it's, you know, being in a courtroom and having to ask difficult questions. And it's funny, you know, as a reporter, you have to have a lot of uncomfortable conversations with people, especially as an investigative reporter. And now I get to have all those uncomfortable conversations with my, you know, with the folks
staff
who I'm working with. So I think temperament's a big part of it. And, you know, I'm lucky because I got to learn from some of the best in the business. You know, one of my mentors is Carol Marine, NBC5, former Sun Times columnist, right. You know, arguably one of the all-time greats. And when I told her I was considering taking the job, she said one of the most beautiful things to me. And it was, Chris, you have a, you know, an editor's mind and a reporter's soul. Don't lose your reporter's soul. So I thought that was great. Now, I haven't been editing for quite some time. I edited quite a bit back in, you know, the early 2000s when I was kind of working as a relief editor. I edited the Saturday night shift. So it's been kind of working out that muscle again, but getting back into this role, but I'm enjoying it immensely.
Well, I mean, that is grateful. A concern. I mean, the concern of losing that sort of reporter's soul or at least losing the sort of feel to the streets or feel to what you've been covering. How do you do that as a managing editor? How do you keep yourself in tune with what's happening around you, keeping your reporter's soul fit?
Yeah, I mean, I think in these first couple of weeks, a couple examples of that is last night, I think, is a pretty nice example. We had a late-breaking story where you had thousands of pages and thousands of electronic documents dumped upon us at City Hall at 4:45. And I was really enjoying it because I was kind of back in the watchdog's office with Mick Dumke and Frank Main and Tim Novak and Dan Mihalopoulos. And we're looking at these spreadsheets and it's like, wow, we're right back at old times. And it's like, well, wait a minute, I'm not writing the story. But I did get to edit that story. And, you know, it made me appreciate, you know, the experience I had in that office. And it made me appreciate those guys all the more. Frank, a Pulitzer winner. You know, Tim, a two-time George Polk Investigative Award winner. You know, Mick Dumke, just a guy who has such a knack for spreadsheet building, sourcing, a great people person and interviewer. And it was interesting to be on the other side of it, kind of helping design the cover for the paper and editing that story. And I think we ended up with a pretty good product that involved a lot of work in a really short time. So it kind of was getting me back in the swing of things.
I mean, we'll talk because I'll keep you after the news here. And I want to talk about just what are some of the challenges of being a managing editor? Because, you know, we'll talk about what it means to be an editor. But also, I mean, it's a management position in the sense that you have to keep the trains running on time. You also have to, you know, a lot of it is the direction of where you want the content to go. But talk before we break. I mean, editor is crucial. It's crucial for a writer. I mean, talk about that relationship and what makes that tick.
Absolutely. I mean, my main editor the past few years has been Paul Saltzman. An editor is somebody who can discipline you in a way that you really don't know you're being disciplined, sort of. It's a little bit like the Jedi mind trick, so to speak. But it's also somebody who you can haggle with and be reasonable with. And Paul, Tim, and I have had so many we talked about like arguments over the years, good-natured ones, and then we hug it all out at the end. But it's like I kind of looked at it, if two of the three of us agree on something, the other one will back down. So it's a collaborative process, and Paul's been great on that for me.
Chris Fusco is the managing editor at the Chicago Sun-Times. I just took that job about 3 weeks ago.
Yep.
We'll continue our conversation. We'll take a break for tonight's news, and we'll get to some of the other things that go into being the managing editor of a newspaper in the second largest market in the country. Chris Fusco, my guest tonight. Stay with us. Thank you, Rob. 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. This is The Download. My guest in studio tonight, Chris Fusco, the new managing editor at the Chicago Sun-Times, longtime investigative reporter with the company, and also before that with the Daily Herald, Northwest Herald, local guy. And you've covered everything. It's amazing to think about all the stories. And I remember working with you 15 years ago on, you know, if Rosemont's going to get the casino license, things of that, you know, like all those stories that you know.
You're taking me back to my dark place.
Exactly. But to talk about, I mean, one of the things about being an investigative reporter is, you know, you're being comprehensive, you're going after what you need to go after, and when the story's done, it's done. Being a managing editor, much different beast.
Yeah, the way I've likened this to people is it's kind of like being a marathon runner versus a sprinter. And, you know, in the investigative reporting role, you're obviously not going as fast, but you're going a long time, and you've got four or five irons in the fire at the same time. And you're trying to bring them home. And what wakes you up at night is, am I really reading this fact correctly? Am I really reading this document correctly? Am I treating this person fairly? Is the presentation of the story going to reflect what we're trying to convey? And those things kind of eat you up and drive you crazy. Now I wake up at night thinking about site stats and chart beat
And literally being woken up by a phone, being like, yeah, I need you, Chris.
waking up in the morning and immediately going to the internet and seeing what's up, you know, picking up the phone, seeing if Jim Kirk has texted me yet. But, you know, and that's fast twitch. And when we're in the newsroom, in the competitive world of search engines and Twitter and Facebook, being first matters. But being first responsibly matters a lot more. Mm-hmm. So we're constantly trying to judge, when do we hit the button on something? When is it ready to go? How can we get those numbers up, you know, on the website to get our traffic going? So it's a lot of split-second decision-making. You're sprinting. Then you take a breath. You grab your cup of water. You get back on the track. And then you sprint to the next thing. Then you go home. You're eating dinner. The phone goes off. You sprint to that thing. You sprint to your home computer. And I'm very fortunate, and tonight's a good example. While I'm waiting in the lobby, I communicated with Maureen Cotter, who's our night editor, three or four times. I was going back and forth over email with Fran Spielman, arguably the greatest City Hall reporter in the country, in history, known to man, and probably some other netherworld beyond that, alternate universe, and Lauren Fitzpatrick, our ed reporter, yeah, who's a young, great reporter, learning a lot and producing great stuff for us. So it's just a crazy, you know. My wife, Lori Rackle, who you know is a Tribune, yeah, you know, former Sun-Times TV critic, she had kind of the same thing when she was on the TV beat, watch this show, ping pong ball this, tweet that. And I was kind of like, what are you doing? And now, you know, I'm the one getting home late, and she's just like looking at me, you know, with a raised eyebrow, right? Saying, I told you so. So it's a good thing we've got a journalist marriage that understands these kind of things.
I mean, take us to, you know, obviously this is more of like a job interview question, but what do you want to accomplish with the newsroom at the Sun-Times? What do you believe the brand is and sort of the long-term thinking is for the paper?
Well, I think the brand is so incredibly important to this city at this time. And it's a real honor for me to be in this chair, because when you look at the challenges we're facing, whether it's the pension crisis, you know, the funding crisis surrounding the public schools, crime, you know, on pace to have potentially more than 700 murders this year in Chicago, way up from, you know, recent years' totals. I mean, there's a lot to tackle. And what I want people to realize is that, you know, the men and women of our newspaper, they've been doing this for generations. They do it without asking for much in return. You know, they just want to keep doing it. And so our number one goal is survival and growth. Mm-hmm. You know, we've got a newsroom that is lean and mean, and, you know, people that are able to juggle a lot of different stories at one time. And I want to be able to continue to showcase their work. And, you know, if I do my job well, then they're the ones who get the credit. They're the bylines, you know, and they deserve that credit. So hopefully we can continue to grow the newspaper, grow the clicks, grow the revenue in an environment that's incredibly challenging, and challenges that your industry is facing too, yeah, Justin. We're all facing it. So,
but how do you, I mean, I in this job, and I ask you this as managing editor, I mean, how do you keep your staff motivated? Because it's a young staff, but it's also a staff that's all the things you just mentioned, from pensions to murders to violence to everything in between. I mean, you can't cover it all, but yet you have to. How do you keep them motivated, not burnt out, and sort of recognize that this is a tough job?
Right. One of the things that Jim has talked about, Jim Kirk, our publisher and editor, is we're going to pick our spots. You know, we think we have a good idea of what our audience wants. You know, I think case in point, you know, I completely understand the point of the view of the Chicago police officer who picks up the paper every morning and is angry, right? You know, pendulum swing, you know, the situations with Laquan McDonald, other shootings by cops of unarmed young black men, you know, the situation with cameras now being able to record officer behavior, you know, those things get in the media and they are big stories, right? Because we've never had that technology in the past. That said, I think the typical Chicago cop, who probably is a little bit angry with us every morning, also trusts us. They trust our reporting, and they've been getting the paper for years, and they know that we call it like we see it. You know, and when a police officer or firefighter tragically is killed in the line of duty, you know, those are big stories for us too. So I think the credibility we've built up as a news organization over the years really is something that's there with readers, and I want to maintain that credibility. And I think that's what motivates our staff. You know, we call it like we see it. Don Hayner, the editor before Jim Kirk, always used to have a phrase. He's like, you don't mess with the news. You know, the news is the news. And if we all have that mindset, I think we can succeed if the industry conditions allow us to.
Just sort of getting us to current events, I mean, we see what's happening with some of the major newspapers in this election cycle where they are almost, you know, putting their you see with the Washington Post and New York Times, they've almost become sort of demonized or vilified by partisan politics. Be a whole alt-right that says these are papers that are, you know, mouthpiece for the left, mouthpiece for Hillary Clinton. How do you, in this day and age, when there's so much that swirls around these generalities and about the news, about the newspapers, how do you manage that as a managing editor? How do you make sure that you develop a level of trust with a reader that you're on the up and up, that you are unbiased?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think some of the things you're citing, Justin, they've been there historically, right? You know, somebody endorses, an editorial board endorses X candidate, and somebody calls up and says, I'm going to cancel the paper, you know? The Tribune endorsement of Gary Johnson was, you know, incredibly, you know, controversial. You know, we endorsed Hillary Clinton. I'm sure we got some of those calls too, right? You know, but there's a firewall between what the editorial board does and what the news side does. So, you know, those things have always been there, and I think they were there. You guys probably got calls back when you were WBZ of somebody not liking a certain piece. The difference now is everybody has a megaphone. Through social media, through blogs, and some of this is just being, I think, a little bit thicker skinned, to not let it get to you when folks are maybe on the attack or they disagree with the tenor of a story. You know, again, we report the news, so this is the way we see the facts. You're welcome to disagree with the facts. You can express that on social media or our Facebook page if you like, or by tweeting at us, You know, we just keep doing what we're doing.
Chris Fusco is the managing editor of the Chicago Sun-Times. We're talking about the future direction of the paper. He's just became the new managing editor. That position was vacant for about a year.
Yes.
Let's talk about, I mean, you know, we had Bruce Sagan in here not too long ago. We had Jim Kirk's been on the program. And we talked about, you know, you even said it just now about picking battles, where you want to be. You know, you're an investigative reporter. Does this signal, by making an investigative reporter the managing editor of a newspaper, that that's your bread and butter? That's where you guys are going to expand and continue to do that kind of work?
Well, that's always kind of been our bread and butter, whether it's Chuck Neubauer or the late Charlie Nicodemus, whether it was Mark Brown, our columnist now, working on stories about Dan Rostenkowski with Neubauer back in the day. You know, I've already talked about Tim Novak and how much I've learned from him being my partner. There's a lot of institutional memory still at the paper between Mark, Tim, Fran, and Lynn Sweet and others. But what I think Jim was trying to do here was send a message. I mean, I'm in the managing editor role. Steve Warmber is in the now the innovation digital side, digital editor role. And I think by having the two of us there, it sends the right message. You know, Steve can number crunch like nobody's business. He can read court documents quickly, and he's taking those skills in. He's continuing to work with John Seidel, our federal courts reporter, and he's manipulating our page and understanding how to kind of work all these platforms to grow our traffic. That said, when we have an investigative story that needs a presence online, he's also going to know, what do we do from a video standpoint? What do we do in terms of raw documents that we want to put up? You know, what sources do we want to reach out to? And Steve and I haven't really had our first really big breaking news test yet, but I'm confident that with like the two of us there working alongside Paul Saltzman, who's been a longtime investigative editor, working alongside Scott Fornick, who knows politics, that we can collectively put our heads together and do a good job. And in addition to that, you know, I think a lot of our reporters, we are preaching the joys of the Freedom of Information Act. I mean, Lauren Fitzpatrick is filing FOIAs left and right. You know, I had to work with Andy Grimm briefly today. We were trying to vet somebody. I said, okay, did you run them through X database? Did you run them through criminal courts? And he's like, I did that. So even our young reporters have that investigative mindset.
Does it blow your mind, I mean, being a sort of veteran of investigative reporting, how these tools have come about for investigative reporters in 2016, whether it be the FOIA Act or other things that make the job that you had to go knock on doors or pick up a phone and hope that they picked up the landline? I mean, I mean, it's amazing how these technological advances have helped investigative reporters. And I would ask, on the flip side, how have they maybe hurt investigative reporters?
Well, I mean, a good example today is look at WikiLeaks. You know, I mean, could you imagine a world 20 years ago, Justin, like where we're sitting in college or journalism classroom and someday there's going to be this thing called the internet where private messages that you write can then be hacked into and put out there for the world to see. And all of you, we would have said that's crazy. I mean, it's like the Jetsons or something. So, you know, there are pluses and negatives. You know, those things, you know, anything that comes out on the internet needs to be verified, and there could be traps laid there for reporters and news organizations. So you got to be very careful about when you go into those things. A lot of documents are just online now. So you may be going to something on deadline and you think, well, this is it. This is what I've been looking for. When in reality, it might not be what you're looking for, or it might be what you're looking for, but you're reading it wrong. So, you know, we've had situations where, you know, I still think the best way to, it's always great to have a sheet of paper. It's always great to be able to read it and to think about what's on it. And mm-hmm. It's always great to call that person who is the subject of that sheet of paper that you're looking at. And we're going to continue to do those things. You know, the electronic world makes it more difficult, and it's got a lot of pluses and negatives.
All right. So last question, just about, you know, you mentioned, you know, waking you up at night is all the, you know, the site numbers and making sure that, you know, things are getting hits. Are you, when you think about it, I mean, and obviously, you know, there's a collaboration at stake here, but for what you guys do at the Sun-Times, but I mean, are you the kind of editor who is going to go, you know, meat and potatoes on the front page of the paper or the front page of the website, or, you know, Kardashian's getting robbed in Paris. That's getting clicks. I mean, is that the kind of thing that you, Chris Fusco, you're gonna be like, you know what, we got to lead with that because that's the new way that journalism works, and everybody wants to read about that, and clicks are what gets us advertising. Where do you stand on that kind of stuff? The idea of balancing that.
I think every day in the news meeting, I'm lucky to work with a lot of people who can approach this with pretty clear heads. You know, we obviously, you know, a lot of people are accusing media of sinking to the lowest common denominator. And clearly, you know, we don't want to do that. The beauty of the internet is you can give the lady what she wants just about whenever she wants it, because the blowhorn is huge, right? So we can put entertainment stories online. We can put the hard news online. You know, how we choose to social mediaize those things out, and a lot of our traffic does come through social media, is we can do the variety, you know. But at the end of the day, I don't think Jim would have installed Steve and I into these jobs, you know, if he didn't want the news. You know, we're not only about entertaining people, but we're about the betterment of the city. And if we operate with that in the backs of our heads, sometimes you have to do what you have to do for the betterment of the city. And ultimately, I think that's what's going to keep us alive, along with providing all those other things too.
Chris Fusco, get back to work.
I will do that.
get back over and keep editing. The new managing editor of the Chicago Sun-Times, Chris Fusco, joined us tonight. Chris, thanks for coming in and talking about your vision for the paper.
Thanks for having me, Justin.
Good to have Chris in. I honestly, we've been working together for a long time. He used to come on shows that I used to produce. You too, I'm sure, Pete. But I remember he was the go-to guy. If you remember when Rosemont was having all those strange scandals around the casino licenses, and they were only going to give out 7, and they were the ones that were going to get one. Chris was all over that. Just like every day I have to write about casino license. If anyone who thinks that being an investigative reporter is glamorous, writing about casino license for 2.5 years. There you go. Coming up, I'm very excited, man. Michael Rooker, John McNaughton. We're going to talk about the Chicago International Film Festival restored 30-year anniversary of Henry, Portrait of a Serial Killer, a tremendous independent film, because not only was it a psychological thriller and considered to be one of the best psychological horror/thriller films of all time, but it really was one of those movies that took on the MPAA, the the rating system because they didn't like the moral tone of the movie and they gave it an X rating. And if you remember X rating, I don't even remember X rated. Like I understand the idea of, you know, adult films, but X rated films, that thing went away because they came up with NC-17. And a lot of that came out of this fight because it wasn't necessarily about, you know, sexual nature. It was just the moral tone of, you know, a portrait of a serial killer. And the MPAA made it very hard for this film to be seen. And it was a huge story. And it was championed by Roger Ebert here in town. So anyway, that's coming up here on The Download. Stay with us. Welcome back to The Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, back in 1986, a low-budget independent film premiered at the Chicago International Film Festival. It was John McNaughton's film, Henry, Portrait of a Serial Killer. And it still stands as one of the best psychological thriller-slash-horror films of all time. That was 30 years ago. And this weekend, the Chicago International Film Festival will pay tribute to the film by presenting a world premiere restored version at the AMC River East 21. That's tomorrow night at 9 o'clock. McNaughton will be on hand for the screening, as well as the lead actor in the film, Henry, Michael Rooker. Rooker was a young actor at the time, and he's since enjoyed a great film career, including roles in Mississippi Burning and Guardians of the Galaxy, just to name a few. And, of course, excelled in television as well, starring in the hit show Walking Dead. Rooker spent his teen years here in Chicago. He went to Wells High School and the Goodman School of Drama, which is now the theater school at DePaul University. Michael Rooker, welcome to The Download. Good to see you.
Hey, good to be here, man.
Also joining us, director John McNaughton, who has directed several films, including Mad Dog and Glory and Wild Things. McNaughton was born here in Chicago, grew up in the Roseland neighborhood, went to school at U of I as well as Columbia College. Mr. McNaughton, good to see you. Thanks for being here.
My pleasure.
All right, well, you know, let's talk about the – I mean, it's amazing to think that this movie was – premiered at the Chicago International Film Festival 30 years ago. What's it mean to you to have this kind of homecoming, to come back and to be part of a restored version 30 years ago at the same festival?
I don't know what to say about that. I mean, again, in my career, I've been reading the Stoics lately, Marcus Aurelius and such, and to accept your fate as it hits you. And like I say, I've been kicked to the curb so many times in this business and you know, took it in stride. So when something wonderful like this happens, I'm not, you know, I should be more happy about it. But it's just like I could take the bad in stride, I'll take the good in stride. Just keep on making movies.
You know, for a restored version, to be able to see a younger Henry on stage, a younger Michael Rooker, what's it mean to you to have this, have such a presentation, to be such a focal point of this festival 30 years later?
Well, yeah, I think it's appropriate because it is 30 years later. I mean, the first time we did it was for the Chicago Film Festival. And so to come back after 30 years, it's like this. It's the little movie that could, you know. It never disappeared. New generations are seeing it over and over and over again. And it's a blast. I mean, it's really cool. Actually, it's great to be back home. And you know, seeing John here, we've seen each other over the years, but this is kind of nice. It's appropriate.
Yeah, we had a good. You know, yeah. There are many actors I've worked with who I'd be just as happy never to see again in my life. but Henry, all of them. I would love to see Tom Tolles again. Unfortunately, he's left us. But yeah, we had a good time. We were a good group, and walked away friends and remained so.
The movie, as I said at the top, still considered one of the best sort of thriller/horrors of all time. Take us to making it. I mean, when I say low budget, we're talking $100,000,
$110,000.
$100,000 for the production. Talk about, you know, how it came together, the process of making this film, Henry, Portrait of a Serial Killer.
Well, it's a very long story, and I won't go into it. I'll eat up all of our time. But eventually, the company in the South Suburbs, MP, was called Maljack at the time, which stood for now called MPI, which still stands for Maljack Productions Incorporated, were two brothers, the Ali brothers, Waleed and Malik. Waleed, unfortunately, is deceased, and they were in the video distribution business, and I knew them from previously, and a day came when they offered me $100,000 to make a horror film. And I happened to see very shortly after that meeting, I walked into someone's office over there, and I had no idea what. You know, they just make a horror film. That's it.
Would you know of the genre at that point?
Oh, I was very conversant with horror films. But, you know, I sort of think that our film, because Michael, Tracy, Tommy all came out of theater, plus Richard Fire, the co-writer, that there's a lot of theater influence in that film, and it is as much a character study and a picture of social realism as it is of the horror genre. But I went to art school, and to me, it's like when it's a work of art, and you take from here, and you take from there, and you take from here, and you take from there, and that's how we got started with that idea. But it was a true story, and we had to take liberties because it did not happen in Chicago, and we didn't have money to leave Chicago, so we set that true story in the environs of Chicago.
Well, I mean, when asked to do a horror film. You know, I mean, that can go in any different direction, especially in the mid-80s, right? I mean, there's a lot of horror that was making from Friday the 13th on that were
great.
Grabbing people's attention.
Great TNA movies.
Right. You know? But, I mean, for you guys, I mean, you talk about that influence, the idea of a theatrical influence and a character-driven story. I mean, I would even say this is more psychological thriller than it is horror because it is just, I mean, it really is about serial killers, but it's really, really about the depth of the characters. I mean, really about what goes through somebody's mind. So it's not horror in the way that we kind of, who's in this cabin out in the woods? It's not that kind of thing, but
we call that Ooga Booga.
Right. So what attracted you, Michael, to that kind of role?
At the time, I was just looking for any kind of role, you know, and I was open for anything practically. I was in the middle of doing a theater piece, and the director of the piece had mentioned that John and those guys were doing this, they're having a little problem finding the lead guy, and I should go over and audition. So I got the address and went on over. I was on my way to work at the time. So I wore my work clothes.
He wore the same clothes that when he showed up to meet myself and Richard Fire for the role. We changed his shoes and nothing else. He wore that Carhartt jacket,
really?
The blue work shirt, the Dickies work pants. That was the Henry outfit.
That was my work clothes at the time. So.
So it saved us a lot of money on wardrobe.
That's how I got cast. And he could save us money on wardrobe.
I'll also say, if you watch the film, before Henry kills anybody, he will always take off his jacket.
Always.
Because we only had one.
we
couldn't get it blood on it.
And I couldn't get blood on it.
I mean, you had $100,000. How far could you stretch $100,000 to make a movie in 1986?
Dude,
I mean,
pretty far. We brought our own lunches. That's
no craft services in this production,
services,
right?
No.
But I mean, really, at that time, and take us back to the mid '80s, to be able to make an independent film, I mean, was that the norm to get that kind of money to get 100? Because now you say an independent film is $10 million, $10-15 million.
Well, like I said, I went to see Waleed one day, and we were going to work on some other project entirely, and there was footage that had to be bought, and the people changed the deal, and they said when they found out that those guys actually had some money that they could afford, I think they asked $10,000, and when they found out that these are real guys with real money, they said, no, we said 20. And and then Waleed and his brother Malik said, you know, we don't deal like that. So they decided not to do that project, and they decided to do this project. So I went to the meeting, and Waleed says, I'll give you $100,000. And as I've often said, if he would have said to me, I'll give you $10, can you make a horror film? I would have said, absolutely.
John McNaught and Michael Rooker in studio with me. Let's take a quick break. They, of course, the lead actor and the director behind the movie Henry, Portrait of a Serial Killer, which is going to be a world premiere, a restored version, is going to be at the Chicago International Film Festival, the exact same place where it debuted 30 years ago. The screening will be tomorrow night at 9 o'clock at the AMC River East 21. We'll take a quick break, and we'll come back here on The Download. Stay with us. Welcome back to The Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Coffin. My guests in studio, John McNaughton, Michael Rooker, the fellows who are behind Henry, Portrait of a Serial Killer, which is getting its 30-year anniversary, and a restored world premiere version will be at the Chicago International Film Festival, the exact same place it started back in 1986. The screening will be tomorrow night at 9 o'clock. John McNaughton and Michael Rooker will be on hand for the screening. Let me ask you guys, I mean, there's one thing about making the film, but then there's another about actually releasing the film, because we keep saying 1986, but it wasn't until a couple years later that it actually saw any sort of theater, because it was a very controversial film. Was it one of the first films that wasn't a sex film to get an X rating? I mean, it was not necessarily welcomed with by the censors.
No, I will just make it brief to say that I remember talking to the lady that it was submitted to the MPAA for a rating, and it came back with an X. They gave it an X, which you can refuse to take the X, but you know then it goes out unrated, which is the same thing. And I had to talk to the lady, and I'm sure the Ali brothers and even myself, I didn't want to cut the film because it was short, at 83 minutes, and it was what the film I wanted to make. But we were asking, well, what can we cut? I remember the lady to this day saying, "Mr. McNaughton, I'm afraid that I have to tell you that there's nothing you can cut in this. We object to the overall moral tone," and that was it. And they just resubmitted it and got basically the same. It's still an X, which I'm rather proud of because it still packs a punch.
So they could do just sort of a moral code. They could say this is an X-rated film.
Well, we never had the cops. There was no hope. Right. When you're a young artist, you want to break the rules. And it's like, well, every story must have hope. But let's make one that doesn't.
Being a part of that film, Michael, I mean, did you guys sense that it was going to be this sort of controversial film?
In the middle of making the movie, no. No, not at all. We're busy doing our thing, And look, then and now, people are making their movies, and they're pre-editing, they're editing their writing style, they're editing the action in the movie and the stuff that's going on in the movie, for the MPAA, for this rating board. And you're not really getting what the artist really wants to show you. So that, and you're getting what the artist really wanted to show you in our movie. Mm-hmm. And that's something to be proud of. That's something over the years that's lasted, multiple generations have seen this movie you either turn around and walk out like some people did in one of our screenings, or you sit and you watch and you sit through it and you're like moved in some way for sure after this movie.
Well, the movie was helped, obviously. Roger Ebert helped it with a good review.
Absolutely.
But talk about how audiences received this movie, because the MPAA obviously put its stamp on saying there's something morally questionable about this film. How did audiences respond?
Well, I have a great story involving Michael and a screening we had at Telluride. But there were two screenings. There was a screening at Telluride, and it was very controversial, and a lot of people walked. But then it started going around the festival that this was a serious film, and Roger Ebert got behind it. May he rest in peace. He was very kind to us. And so they put on a second screening. So the screening goes up, and I think Michael and I may have introduced it, and our editor Elena was there, and Steve Jones was there, and a bunch of us were there. And so we didn't watch the film. We went across the street and got a beer and a hamburger or something, and we were coming back at the end. Well, it was an old theater that used to have those porthole windows in the doors so you could see into the theater.
Right.
And we looked in, and it was at the home invasion, the famous home invasion scene, and Michael was standing in the lobby, and we saw this young lady jump up from her seat and come firing down the aisle because she was walking. And Michael just like saw her coming. So he turned around, back to the, and she comes blasting through the door, and Michael turns around and goes, "Boo!" And Michael is a very warm and gregarious person if you really know him, not at all like the character. And this gal I thought was going to, we'd have to call the ambulance. And but Michael comforted her and hugged her and it was and everything, But
I offered her a ride home.
Right. Well, Michael, let's talk about the role, because this was your first film. This was one that obviously was very intense, and even your process, and you talked about it a little bit on Bill and Wendy today, just the process of setting yourself up for it. It's kind of famed how you sort of, kept yourself away from the other cast. Talk about that. What goes into that? What kind of intensity goes into that as an actor to play someone like Henry?
First off, just to play that role, you look at it and you're like, "Ooh, I don't know if I can play this. I don't know what I'm not sure how to do this yet," and it's a little scary. You're not sure what path you're going to take. Mm-hmm. So because of that, I decided to not at first. To sort of stay in character, But I found it much, much more difficult to go in and out and joke with everybody and then not joke with everybody. And then, so I just decided to stay where I was, stay in the mood, stay in, keep my bubble, keep myself safe from all the other influences around me.
You were a theater actor at the time. Was that similar to the process that you would do to other roles?
Sometimes. It depends on the role. But this role was a little different. And so I just, made that choice. I just made the choice to do it that way.
What do you have to grab from to do a role like this? I mean, in your personal life, to be able to understand the role and to grab. I mean, as an actor, what's the inspiration? What do you have to dig deep to find?
I don't, you know what? I'm not sure if you have to dig too deep. It depends on who you are, how you're raised, and how you're brought up, depending on how deep you have to go. But we make jokes about, I think I have uncles that are very similar to this guy. I watched videos of Henry Lee Lucas being interviewed by Texas Rangers, and I watched his body language, and I listened to his tone, and that's kind of where I got a lot of the body language, and a lot of the moodiness. He was sort of like that as well, and then he could be gregarious too. I mean,
he had a charm. He got
charming,
next to people. You know, he was able to get next to people, and he did it through this odd charm.
Natural ability to make people smile back.
You know, I asked Michael as the actor. I mean, John as a director. I mean, you don't really think about it this way, but it's similar in the way. What do you have to draw upon to get the tone right to be able to put Henry Portrait of Serial Killer together? I mean, where are you going to find the finished product, the tone that we've seen in the movie?
Roseland.
Really?
I mean, Roseland is a tough...
Growing up.
Growing up amongst people who aren't, or from less than stellar backgrounds, and some pretty tough kids and some pretty tough families and some pretty hard roads traveled. And also, by the time I got to make the film, I had, I had traveled the United States and Canada with a traveling carnival, and there were a lot of real hard cases that worked in that group. And those people have always been the people that influenced me. The people who have everything, Skippy in their lives, they don't make for very interesting stories, mm-hmm. So.
But that's not to say they can't.
It's not to say they can't. No, you can. I mean, Shakespeare is about royalty, and it's pretty good. But I just find, I was always sort of, as Jack Kerouac said, I always attracted to the mad ones. Those are the ones that have stories,
Well, I mean, there's something to be said about both of you growing up in Chicago. I mean, as a teenager, you were over in Division Ashland, sort of what we know now as sort of the Wicker Park, mm-hmm. Wells High School, Roseland, which is an entirely different area now. But the concept being that, those were working class neighborhoods. I mean, you really had
in
to.
In the day, they were quite a rough and tumble place.
So do you, both of you, and we'll talk about this, we'll take a quick break in just a second, but, I want to find out, how much of that inspires you as artists today? I mean, not just with the role in Henry or the directing and putting that film together, but in your works after the fact, what we see in the characters that you choose to portray, how much of that do you draw from that Chicago experience? That's
good.
Cool. Yeah. All right, I've primed you guys. We'll take the break. We'll come back. Michael Rooker, John McNaughton, my guests tonight. They, of course, Michael was Henry from Henry Portrait of a Serial Killer, John McNaughton's film, that will be at the Chicago International Film Festival tomorrow night, 9 o'clock. A restored world premiere, a 30-year anniversary since the year that it was introduced in 1986. Both of them in town for the screening. We'll take a quick break. We'll come back. Stay with us. Welcome back to The Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Michael Rooker and John McNaughton, my guests in studio. We're talking about Henry Portrait of a Serial Killer. It's being restored and will be presented at the Chicago International Film Festival tomorrow night, 9 o'clock. River East 21 right here around the corner in Streeterville. It's so interesting as we talk, right before the break, we were talking about where you draw for not only the character but the tone of this film. And Chicago came up as an answer for both of you guys. Talk about what Chicago means to you, or means to this film. Why don't we start there? I mean, it's so amazing to see the film and see a lot of Chicago that's just not there anymore. This is 30 years ago. Talk about what you were trying to grab by using Chicago as a backdrop for the story.
Well, the main reason we use Chicago backdrop for the story, because it didn't occur, that it is based on a true story that did not occur anywhere near Chicago. But, I mean, we had $100,000, so we weren't going to be out on traveling on the road. And
but you could have done – you could have picked different places in Chicago. What was it about the
Well,
the
I studied still photography at Columbia College as my minor subject, but it was my passionate subject because it was, you know, art. And used to spend a lot of time out in the streets taking pictures of – yeah, Chicago is a tremendously photogenic place, and I posted something about that, posted a picture, and someone said, well, have you ever been to Paris? I go, yeah, I've been to Paris quite a few times, and it's beautiful, and it's way more beautiful than Chicago, but it's not more photogenic. So I had all these places, kind of a lot of the locations. Oh, yeah, this scene, oh, I know this place, and I know that place. And, you know, we shot a scene out on the south side of what we used to, 99th Street Beach with Michael, that got cut out. But, you know, and some stuff we found new, but a lot of stuff was already, you know, in my memory bank. That would be a great place to do such and such. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that's how a lot of locations got picked.
Yeah, but but there's also a grittiness to it. And, you know, you could shoot a movie today in Chicago and it'd be, you know, like you just said, it's such a photogenic place. It'd be majestic. It could be anything it wants. In this film and the tone that you took, there is a grittiness to the Chicago that's represented.
Well, you know, you're the old neighborhood.
Vision and Ashland, right?
Enough said.
Yeah,
you know it's a gritty place.
Well, telling the story about Richard, told the story, but we were shooting it where
Richard
he grew
Fire,
up,
our writer,
and we're trying to get quiet. We're out on the street, and Richard Fire was like, perhaps he had a beer or two, perhaps, and you know, he was telling people to shut up. Well, these were gang kids. He's telling to shut up, and Richard Fire was, you know, was not a tough guy. He was a man of the theater, and it's starting to get ugly, you know? Like, one guy just kept yelling and yelling, and we couldn't get quiet. And I'm looking at the people around us, I go, you know, if you know where, you know, Richard doesn't know who, Richard should be, calm down, Richard, because these are not people that you want to, like,
right,
get in their face.
Right.
You know, I'm telling you. And then I'll let Michael tell the rest of the story.
We're filming the scene with the lady and the little dog. Remember that?
Yeah.
A little sidebar. I did the dog. The little voice in the dog.
Yeah.
Yeah, I did the voiceover for the dog.
I'm telling you, this is the DVD track here.
So we're filming that little moment, and we're in the back alley. It's a dead end alley, as a matter of fact.
Right off north. It's on North Avenue.
And we're in the middle of shooting it, and here comes about, you know, 18, 20 guys down the alleyway, block our way. And they want to know where the big mouth is. They want him. Where is he?
They want him.
Nobody didn't want to say anything. I think I was the first one to speak up, and I said, he's right there. You can have him. But can we keep him for about 2 more weeks? We need him for 2 more weeks, then he's all yours. And so I made it into a joke. But in the process, one of the leaders of this group spoke up and then said, animal, is that you? And I go, yeah. It was my buddies from high school. They're all my friends.
So saved by your relationship.
Saved by
right?
my relationships from the guys at Wells High School.
Wells High School comes in handy. Well, I mean, there is. I mean, it's fame that you didn't have money for extras, so a lot of it were just pedestrians that walked
well,
by,
as
right?
As a matter of fact, after that night, I think, didn't they help police the area?
Well, after that we broke, after he, you know, then they were going around and keeping the area quiet. They, you know, hey, shut up over there.
They were policing the area for
another area you could cut corners. You had your own security staff that was volunteer from Wells High School. All right, you know, as I mentioned, you know, the idea of these places, I mean, these Roseland, Division and Ashland, where you guys grew up, where, you know, you not only sort of, you know, spent your days, but the impact it had on you. Talk about how do you take that with you with your career when you're doing other movies, when you're doing Mad Dog and Glory, or when you're doing Guardians of the Galaxy. Are you thinking about, you
well,
know?
Well, I'd have to use some profanity, but there was one scene in Mad Dog and Glory where the guy was, same thing. It was a crime scene, and he was yelling at he at these, you know, the people who were on the street, and he was being very polite. And I said, you know, that's not how – he was a New York cop. It was supposed to be originally set in New York, but we wound up shooting it here. And I won't go into what he actually said, but, you know, it became very profane. And I go, oh, yeah, that's how you speak it in the, you know,
right.
on the street.
So, I mean, what when you're doing roles, Michael, what do you – where are you – I mean, where does Chicago play in digging down to find your point of view, your tone?
Well, I've always been a very I'll take that back. I haven't always been very physical, very open to any sort of physical
conflict
or altercation or anything like that. But I don't choose to find it, you know. And I was always as a younger kid when I first got to Chicago. I was a wee bit meek, and I was a very skinny little guy. But you'd have to push me and push me and push me until I struck out. Mm-hmm. But when I struck out, it was usually I'm striking out for good. Mm-hmm. I don't care to have you get back up, you know, that kind of thing. And so I've always sort of been that way. Growing up in this kind of neighborhood, people would get in fights all the time. And just, I couldn't see how they did that. Why did they do this kind of stuff? I mean, they just do it to have fun doing it. And I never had fun doing it. And I was trying to learn how to have fun beating people up and stuff like that. But I never had fun doing it. And but my friends all had a good time doing it. They really enjoyed doing this kind of stuff. And that sort of gets into you after a while. You know, and I was like, I just don't want to be like this. I don't want to be like that. And so I got into martial arts. I took judo and aikido and all this kind of stuff, so I could actually get physical and do stuff and throw people and have physical conflicts in a mock situation, which helped me feel better about, you know, if I ever had to get into a confrontation, I wouldn't feel like really hurting you, you know. I'd feel like just defending myself and you'll be able to walk away afterwards. But earlier, it wasn't that way.
But that, I mean, there's something about that. I mean, that temperament, the concept of having it, not necessarily a chip on your shoulder, but being ready to protect yourself, defend yourself mm-hmm. in that form.
I think every kid should know how to defend themselves and protect themselves.
I would say that I wonder, both of you as artists, I mean, as an actor, as a director, going into Hollywood and living that life where it's project to project, where there's a lot of, I mean, even you, Michael, I mean, you have a movie every year, you're a recognizable face, you get stopped on the street, but I would assume in your career there's been rejection,
you gotta fight, you gotta know how to fight. And growing up in these kinds of neighborhoods, you learn to fight. And you can learn to fight dirty or you can learn to fight clean.
Right.
And I always enjoyed fighting clean. And I know how to fight dirty, but I choose not to. But that translates sometimes into the scenes that you're working on. Like with, for example, JFK. Oliver Stone loved having the actors fight in the scenes. He wanted you to fight for the focus. He wanted you to fight for whose line was more important. He didn't want to write it in a way that this line is the most important line. You guys have to get kowtow to this. Build up to this line. No. He'd let you fight it out. He'd put you in a room and you'd physically, verbally fight out this scene.
Wow.
And it turned out to be sometimes absolutely great scenes because of that, because of that energy. And I think a lot of artists and a lot of actors, whether they've grown up in a pretty rough and tumble neighborhood like we did or some other other kind of neighborhood, You kind of have that already, you know, and it's sort of inside you.
You got to go get it.
Yeah.
John, for you, and you mentioned this in Bill and Wendy as well today, just the idea of this being an art film, you know, and you said don't let Hollywood hear that because, you know, like that's a business, that's an entertainment business.
Yep.
That's an area they're not interested in making art films.
Nope.
For you as an artist, as someone who wanted to make art films, you know, the same stuff that Michael's talking about, this idea of persevering, this idea of being able to handle and roll with the punches and be able to fight for that energy, that's a big part of being a director or making films in Hollywood.
Yeah, not giving up, for sure.
Yeah. Well, you know, again, the interesting thing with Henry was, like I said, Waleed Ali gave us the money, and the, you know, the money was there when it needed to be there. It was a four hunks of $25,000 each. But I remember Richard Fire and I were working on the script and et cetera, et cetera. It was getting time. It was coming up on winter, and we had to get out and shoot the movie if we were going to shoot the movie. So I called Waleed, and I sent him the script. This was before I could email him the script, and dropped the script. And I said, I'll come back in a week, give you a week to read it. And, you know, I knew he was busy. So a week later, I called him. I said, well, Waleed, have you read the script yet? And he said, John, you know, I've been very busy. No, I haven't read the script, but it's coming and I'll give you the first check and I'm sure it'll be fine. That is not the way you make movies in Hollywood. You've got a lot of folks that each want to have something to say about every creative aspect, and that becomes your fight. You have to fight them. No, that's a bad idea. You know, I mean, it's amazing the bad ideas that they come up with.
It's an art to that, right? Yeah.
But this man, I talk about fighting. He's fought for this film from day one until even now today. I remember going, you know, I'm the actor, man. I got to go on. I got to make a living. I got to work at other things. And that's what I did. But I would come back and visit her, say, what you doing, man? What's up with him? And he'd go, well, we got this going on. We had this going on. Henry may be able. You were still pitching and pushing.
Well, that was my career. Without that, if that film wasn't seen, then I had no career. And right. I actually went, I think, like 16 months without any income whatsoever. When it was first finished, it was not well regarded. Yeah. It was not loved. And it had to get pushed and pushed and pushed until it hit a critical mass.
And so, bam, he fought tooth and nail every single day to get this movie seen.
And here it is, 30 years later.
Here
you are. I mean, I just kind of wraps this up to where we started. And I'll ask the same question, and maybe after our conversation, elicit some different response. But, you know, to all the things we talk about, fight and all the things that we've discussed here, to be back at the Chicago International Film Festival 30 years later, with all the fanfare and everybody wanting to see this, what's it mean to you?
I can't say. I don't know. I don't know what it means.
I got a couple of words. Yeah. Told you so.
Yeah. There it is.
Bam. That's kind of it. Yeah, that kind of sums it up, you know?
John McNaught and Michael Rooker in studio tonight. They are going to be both at the screening of the world premiere restored version of Henry, Portrait of a Serial Killer, which will be at the Chicago International Film Festival tomorrow night, 9 o'clock at AMC River East 21, right around the corner here in Streeterville. 30-year anniversary since the first time it premiered. The first showing was at the International Film Festival in 1986. John, Michael, thanks so much for being my guest tonight. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
It's been fun.
Ooh, listen to this track. Oh, I faded it out. Strong track, though. Getting real disco-y. Getting very deep cut, not a drum and bass, but would you call it electronica? Yeah, I didn't know you had it in you, Pete.
Oh yeah.
Are you like a secret lover of electronica? And I didn't know this.
I dabble in all styles of.
Are you the guy that gets home and you just put on your huge headphones and you're just like get lost in the trance?
Yeah, that's me.
That was great. Those guys were great, weren't they?
Yeah, so good. So fun.
Michael Rooker's great. I tried, or this morning I was talking to my son, 9-year-old, big fan of Guardians of the Galaxy.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, hey, guess who I'm interviewing today? Michael Rondo. He played Yondu on Guardians of the Galaxy. He's like,
Wasn't interested, huh?
Wasn't interested. I'm like,
And he sat down and showed him the Henry Portrait of a Serial Killer.
Watch this trailer.
You're looking for a horror movie to get. I don't know if that was this is the way to go.
That's right. A couple weeks ago, I was trying to see what's the entree for horror films for a 9-year-old? Henry, Portrait of a Serial Killer. But it's amazing to think that's, you know, for $100,000, you can make a movie like that. And then 30 years later, they're at the International Film Festival again. It's pretty cool. All right, coming up, I'm really excited about our next segment. You know, obviously, now's the time for haunted houses and Halloween, all that kind of stuff. But and with that comes ghost stories. A lot of ghost stories. And we talk about urban legends and urban myths and the ghosts, whether it be, you know, someone haunting the Trib Tower or possibly, you know, I'm trying to think of like the Mary in the cemeteries.
Resurrection Mary.
Yeah, Resurrection mm-hmm. Mary. Well, Free Street Theater's come up with a new show called 100 Hauntings. And they've crowdsourced ghost stories. So essentially they went around to different neighborhoods and they talked to different people about the sort of, you know, stories you hadn't heard about someone on the corner or this person, that person, and they collected the stories together and they present them in the show. I think that's an awesome Halloween show.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, there's always going to be, and we'll talk about that later in the month too, just the sort of fright, kind of shock, haunted house kind of Halloween celebration stage show, you know, like they do in all the big, you know, like, come on out. We're going to kill you with fear. But this, I like this. I like this a lot. So we'll talk with Koi and Bobby coming up here after the news. Stay with us. It's a download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Coming up at 10 o'clock, Chris Jones from the Chicago Tribune is going to join us. We're going to talk about commercial productions in Chicago. We've seen a lot of them lately, like sort of the Cheers on stage, the touring shows that come through. They're not doing well. There was an article today in the Chicago Tribune saying Chicago's kind of rejecting them in a way that they're not getting the audiences they expect, and they are leaving early. So we'll talk with Chris about why that is, why shows that have that are touring, that are commercial, that aren't the sort of Broadway, pre-Broadway tryouts that we see at the Goodman or other places, why they're not doing so well. So Chris will be on the show as well. And we're Catherine DiOrio from Check Please. The new season of Check Please starts tomorrow night on WTTW, so Catherine will join us as well. Well, a new stage show at Free Street Theater takes Halloween and ghost stories in a new direction. It's called 100 Hauntings, and it asks the question, who and what is haunting Chicago? The work comes from Chicago citizens that live everywhere from Humboldt Park to Inglewood. They share their personal stories with hauntings, both literal and metaphorical. It's the brainchild of Koya Paz and Bobby Bedrisky. Koya is the Free Street Artistic Director, and Bobby's a member of the Free Street and a PhD student at Northwestern in the Department of Performance Studies. The show's on stage through December 2nd at Pulaski Park, 1419 West Blackhawk, up on the third floor, the Noble Square neighborhood. Koya, Bobby, thanks for being here.
Thank you. Let's talk about...
Koya, good to see you, too. We've known each other for a long time. All right, so let's talk about where this comes from. I adore this concept, the idea of almost crowdsourcing ghost stories in Chicago.
Yeah, you know, one of the things that we were interested in is talking to people about real ghosts, because there are the kind of urban legend ghosts that we all hear about, and I'm not sure anybody really believes that they're true.
Right.
And yet most people that we've talked to, and we talked to over 300 people in 15 different community sites to collect stories, even people who said they didn't believe in ghosts would usually after a pause say, well, there was this one time, and then go on to describe this incredibly unnerving or emotional or absolutely terrifying event that happened in their laundry room or in the, you know, entryway to their apartment building. And that's what I was interested in, you know, is sort of what do ghosts tell us about the city that we live in and the people that we are?
Yeah, I mean, because there are going to be ghost stories that are very particular to street corners, to specific neighborhoods, things that maybe the urban legend doesn't even leave that block, if you will.
Yeah, for sure. The part of how Koya and I came to this is that we were both really in love with the work of a sociologist named Avery Gordon, who wrote a book called Ghostly Matters, Haunting in the Sociological Imagination, where she was looking at the phenomenon of haunting as a way to study social worlds. So that's exactly what you're describing.
Interesting.
That, like, the ghost is a disruption in what we would perceive as maybe normal everyday life, and it's asking us to notice something that we may have been walking past every day, and it's kind of demanding to not be forgotten and to say, hey, look a little bit closer and figure out what happened here.
Yeah, it's interesting, you know, because it's Halloween time and ghost stories obviously, you know, will become sort of in vogue for a month's time. But when we talk about these ghost stories, they're not just sort of the haunting types. They're not the kind of stuff, you know, you're not finding necessarily the old urban legends of, you know, a guy's hand hitting a car and we all ran, and, you know, like the, I don't even know, like I grew up in a rural area, so it's all about someone's hand brushing up against a car window. But I mean, it isn't just necessarily those kind of like almost horror type driven ghost stories.
No, in fact, it's not even all ghost stories, you know, and one of the things that, you know, we always say, and again, this is pulling from Gordon, so it wasn't entirely our original idea, whether or not the ghost is real, the fact that somebody says the ghost is real, and that's worth asking a question yeah. about. And even Resurrection Mary, which we were talking about a little bit off air, is like the most famous ghost in Chicago. I mentioned it to this woman who's, one, you know, kind of old school Irish from Chicago. And she's like, oh, that's just some story they made up to keep, you know, Irish kids from making out in the cemetery, you know. And like, I thought that was so funny, you know, to think about even these urban legends have a purpose, too, if you investigate. But actually, our, you know, not everything that haunts us in this city is a ghost, you know, and that's one of the things that we try to talk about in the play is sort of what are the other things that keep reappearing or come back in unexpected moments, these things that we can't shake even though we try to. And that's where the play gets really, the whole process got really emotional.
For you guys, yeah. I mean, so talk about finding those stories. You know, you talked to 300 Chicagoans. How do you cull it down to a stage show? How does the process work?
It's a lot. I mean, the process itself, I think that's what we're both also in love with, is the process of making ensemble-based theater and doing theater that's rooted in interview work or in stories that are coming from a wide part of Chicago, all over the city, north, south, not really east because there's a lake there, right? But west as well. And then, so the process of finding those stories was, I don't want to speak for Koya, but for me, that was the most, I loved that. Sitting with people and listening to them tell you about loved ones that have come back and visited them, or about what they think haunts their neighborhood, whether that is political corruption or the police,
right,
or
right.
whatever that is, right? People, when they came to the workshops, were really honest. And I think that then what happens as an art maker, when people are that honest and they give you these incredible gifts of their own personal experience and the way that they're experiencing the city, is that you feel a great deal of, we want to take care of those stories, you know, and you want to share them with other people because they've given you the permission to do so. So that is a hard process to say which ones are going to end up in the show now. I think hopefully we were able to look through and say, here's major themes that came right. up over and over and over again, along with here are these really specific instances that just people have to hear.
Do you have to prompt people when you say, okay, we're looking for what haunts you, to talk, not, you know, because automatically your brain will go, okay, well, I'm going to think of a ghost. Oh, yeah, there was that thing in the laundry room. Do you have to prompt them to think about some of the other issues, like you're talking about, the social issues, political corruption, crime, policing, things that might be a different way to think of the word haunt?
Yeah, I mean, when we did the workshops, we had a set of about 8 questions. And so we would play a warm-up game, and then we would ask these questions and ask people to write down a short answer to it. And they kind of led people into this question of other things. But actually, people were, over and over again, really reluctant to talk about the supernatural and very excited to talk about the other things. You know, everyone wants to talk about a corrupt politician.
Right.
And, you know, for example, I remember talking to this one woman who I asked her if she had a ghost story, a supernatural one. And she was like, well, I wasn't drunk. I don't want you to think I was drunk. And she said that like 12 times while she was telling me the story, that she wasn't drunk, but that she was sure this thing had happened. And what I realized is, some people are really embarrassed to say that they have seen a ghost, or it right. seems unscientific or irrational, but they are not embarrassed to say, you know what, Chicago's really segregated, or you know what, the bus never comes, or you know what, these things are really a problem right. in my life, and so is this creature who keeps showing up at 3 a.m, but I don't want to talk about that.
We don't want to talk about that.
Yeah.
Koya Paz and Bobby Bedrisky are the are with Free Street. Koya is the artistic director of the Free Street Theater, also Bobby is a member of Free Street, and he's a PhD student at Northwestern in the Department of Performance Studies. The show is called 100 Hauntings. It's on stage through December 2nd at Pulaski Park, 1419 West Blackhawk. That's in Noble Square. Let's take a quick break. We'll come back. And I'd love to get to some of the specific things that people talked about or what you guys showcase in the show. And then I also want to get to the process. You guys, I mean, you have to have been evolved over time to do this kind of theater, to be able to collect stories and be able to present them. Talk a little bit about the editing process that you have acquired that skill by doing shows at Free Street, and talk about the mission of Free Street coming up here. On the download, stay with us. It's the download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. In studio with me, Koya Paz and Bobby Bedrisky. That's close. I'm trying, man. I'm doing my best.
You're doing great.
To run right through that name. Koya is the Free Street Theater Artistic Director. Bobby, a member of the company. You know, I'm interested because the show is 100 Hauntings. We're talking about sort of crowdsourcing ghost stories, but not just ghost stories, the concept of hauntings. And that could mean, that could be literal, that could be metaphorical. The show that you went and found 300 people to interview around the city, so many different areas, to put a show on at Free Street. It's on stage through December 2nd at Pulaski Park, 1419 West Blackhawk in Noble Square. It's a tremendous idea because, as I said before we started the segment, you know, far too often we lean on the stories of the urban legends that we know of Chicago that, like you said, with Resurrection Mary, just aren't true or, you know what, are just kind of old hat. Like, it's time to move on. So let's talk about some of the specifics, the stories that you guys have uncovered from talking to 300 different people in Chicago. Talk about what's in this show and what you guys discovered.
Yeah, so one of the stories that we tell on the play, so spoiler alert, is, you know, about a theater company that had rented a space in Pilsen. And they were sure that there was a ghost in the basement. And they thought that there was a ghost in the basement for all of the usual reasons, you know, that they go down and it feels cold, the lights come on and off, things crash. So they entered into this really complicated relationship with the ghost, you know, like talking to it, leaving it food, trying to like bring in a señora to wipe the ghost out. And they have found out that, you know, that one of those black tour buses would come by all the time, and they found out that the tour bus was coming to their space.
Really?
Because a woman had, it had been a speakeasy during Prohibition, and a woman had been murdered and buried in the basement. And when we first did the show as a kind of campfire tour in the summer, and we told that story as like, dun, 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 because a lot of ghost stories have this kind of confirmation,
yeah, right?
Like you, and the proof is
right,
whatever.
Right.
But then we were talking about it, like, wait a second. Someone was murdered and buried in the basement. And is there a way to tell this story that has some empathy for this
right.
ghost? And of course, she's a mad ghost. And like,
right.
you know. And so we tried to really think about, like, what are these ghost stories telling us beyond just like, oh, it's scary. I'm not going to renew my lease, you know. Or, for example, we had another... one of the famous stories about, you know, it's one of these urban legends, is that there's a Hooters at Erie and Wells
sure.
that is haunted. When you look deeper into that story, there was a body snatching ring at the corner of Erie and Wells. And so that took us in.
Body snatching ring.
Yes, because in the 1870s, people were sort of just discovering kind of human anatomy, and medical doctors and scientists really needed bodies. And so they were like taking bodies from the poorhouse. They were snatching immigrant women off the
Yikes.
Street.
Yeah.
But they were... You know, we went into the archive because the urban legend said that they had found all these women's bodies stuffed into barrels marked poultry, and now it's a Hooters. And I was like, I'm trained as a historian, and that doesn't seem true to me. You know, that seems like a sick joke. But actually, it was a body snatching ring. They were in barrels marked grain and flour,
okay.
things like that. But there's something,
but still, yeah.
Yeah, that this was the site of this really terrible violence that we wouldn't actually remember was a huge part of Chicago history if there weren't this ghost story that keeps repeating.
So the stories almost are the history lesson in the way that we can understand and have some empathy for the fact that these were real things that happened around these buildings that in this day, if it were 2016, and there was a body-snatching ring and it was discovered at Hooters, that'd be a big deal, yes. Right? That'd be a huge deal.
We hope so.
It was in the 1870s, right. Too. You read the Tribune from February 28th, 1872, and it's just days and days of like, and the body snatching ring.
Wow. I did not know that. Oh, there you go. So okay, those are two stories that you can, see on stage at 100 Hauntings, which is a show that Free Street's putting on through December 2nd at Pulaski Park. It opens next Thursday, right? Previews have started, but it opens next Thursday, 1419 West Blackhawk. You know, you guys have been doing Free Street for a long time. I mean, Koya, this is... forgot the number, 28 years of doing Free Street Theater. I don't know if you've been involved the entire time, but...
No, I'm so young.
But
Free Street has actually been around since 1969. Whoa. We're in our 48th year of making theater by, for, about, with, and in Chicago's diverse communities. It was one of the first racially integrated theater companies in Chicago and was expressly started before I was born, for the record, to make theater that defies Chicago's segregation. We all know Chicago is the most segregated city in the country, racially and economically. And so Patrick Henry, who founded the company, said, how could we use theater to bring people together and to say that these are false divisions? And let's use storytelling and let's perform in neighborhoods all over the city. You shouldn't have to come to the theater. The theater can come to you. That's important in a city as big and segregated as Chicago.
Yeah, right.
And we're very proud now in 2016 to be continuing that mission. You know, we don't have, you know, long hair and tie-dye and tambourines anymore. You look at the early footage of Free Street and it's great, but it's very 60s and 70s. We're trying to be the 2016-2017 version of what Chicago needs.
Bobby, why'd you get involved in Free Street?
All the reasons that Koya just said and more, wanting to do this kind of project, being able to collaborate on this kind of project is what I want to do. And this is not the kind of thing that necessarily I would be able to do at another larger theater. You know, like this is a community project, and it was Free Street is important to me in the sense that I think its ethics run through the whole thing, not just in the ethos of one particular project, but through the entire organization. We do amazing things there, like offer childcare during shows and for any of our cast members that need childcare while we're in the rehearsal process. And we're kind of running on an economic model that doesn't make a lot of sense in regard to the fact that all of our shows are pay whatever you want to pay. And we still are able to pay our actors and to pay our designers and stuff like that. So that kind of removal of a lot of the barriers, both perceived and real, that folks feel to theater in Chicago is the whole reason I want to be involved there.
It's great. And for a program or a project like this, I mean, it is a multimedia form of journalism in the way that you're collecting these stories. You have to edit them and then present them. But it is a sort of performance journalism.
Yeah, that's exactly what it is. All of our shows are themed. So we kind of pick an idea and track it. We think, how does this really affect us in this city? And, you know, we always joke that Free Street is a little bit theater for people who hate theater. it is not your sort of traditional play structure at all. You know, we want to bring people in who wouldn't necessarily have a great time at a different kind of play. So we try to be funny. We also try to be smart. But most of all, we try to be real. You know, we try to reflect the city that we live in with the things that we do.
Sounds great. Koya Paz, Bobby Barisky. Koya is the Free Street Artistic Director. Bobby, a member of Free Street, also a PhD student at Northwestern, a Department of Performance Studies. The show is called 100 Hauntings. It's Who and What is Haunting Chicago? It's on stage through December 2nd at Pulaski Park, 1419 West Blackhawk in Noble Square. What's a website? What's a good website for people to check out?
Freestreet.org.
Freestreet.org. Bobby, Koya, thanks for coming in.
Thank you so much for having us.
Good to see you. Thanks, Rob. It's Download here at 720 WGN. I thought we changed the locks. I thought the key card had been taken away from Chris Jones, the chief theater critic at the Chicago Tribune. But I guess somehow he got in the building. It's good to see you, buddy.
It's nice to be here. You know, I thought I had a show and I didn't have a show, so I thought, well, no, I don't want to cancel on Justin. I'm going to stick around, do a bit of work.
So,
and, you know,
oh, no, man, you stayed on, man.
I stayed on. Aww. I stayed and did some work, and then I found myself on StubHub, Justin. I guess I did. And Sunday night, there were these two tickets that came up, section 516.
5,000, yeah.
Two and a quarter for me and my boy, each. Two and a quarter.
To go see
Sunday night.
Please don't
night,
say, I was gonna say, please night. Don't say Bears Jaguars.
Two and a quarter, and I hit go. Wow. And then I look at them and I go and I see that little restricted view thing.
Oh no.
I'm like, oh. What do you think? Two and a quarter? Is that ridiculous?
I don't think it's ridiculous. Pete would know better. He goes to the games and he would say no, it's not ridiculous. Pete, what do you say?
No, I think that's a fair
that's all
price.
Right.
Yeah.
And what about that? What about that restricted view thing in the 500s? Is that going to be all right?
Well,
lean round the pillar there.
I sit. Our seats are in the 500 section, and the only way that's restricted is if, like, you're behind one of the poles that
yes,
are up there.
Yes, I have a feeling yeah. that is in fact the case. Yes.
But that's not. That doesn't mean you're right behind it. It means that you might not be able to see the second baseman from your right. line
yes.
of sight or something
for,
like that.
For two and a quarter, Pete.
That's
yeah.
it's worth
quarter.
It.
Right.
You're going to see history.
Yeah, it is.
You're going to see history. It's such a Cubs fan. You're going to see history. Right now, the Dodgers leading the Nationals in the seventh inning 4-1, so we'll keep an eye on that for the rest of the year. Chris, let's talk about some theater stories. You know, obviously, we haven't talked in a while,
no.
but Hamilton, the big
yeah.
story that it's been in previews. I've seen everybody's Facebook page with the Hamilton, you know, program.
I was in the room where it happened.
So Wednesday, so Wednesday is actually the
yes.
the first show of Hamilton.
Wednesday is, as far as the likes of me are concerned, the opening night after about 2.5 weeks of previews. And the show is pretty much clean, as they say in the biz, for about a year. So they've pretty much sold pretty much every ticket for the next year. There's a few scattered tickets, I'm told. And if you got the big bucks, the Cubs bucks, you can, if you will, got that two and a quarter or more, then you can maybe snag yourself a seat. But it remains a difficult ticket for people. And we'll find out if the Chicago production sort of is up to snuff on Wednesday night. I imagine.
Is that how it works? I mean, do you review on opening night?
Yes, I'm going Wednesday night.
Skip preview? I thought that's what previews are for.
Well, previews are, before I show up, basically. And then Wednesday, so they're all here working on it all weekend.
Okay, okay.
The great Lin-Manuel Miranda, I suspect, is skulking around town at this very moment, maybe, or certainly later in the weekend. And then I imagine he'll be there Wednesday night, and then basically all the creatives will clear off and they'll put their mind to London and Los Angeles mm-hmm. and all the other companies of Hamilton, and that will be it. And that's the end of the process for Chicago beginning Wednesday night. And that's the big thing. And, every indication is that it'll be a great show.
And that's a show, obviously, that could run for years. I mean, it's open-ended on how.
There's no question it's at least a year, and my suspicion is it will be 2, if not 3 years.
Wow. All right, so there you go. So if you maybe next year you get
yeah.
that two and
I mean,
a quarter.
And they're all making download kind of money in
yeah.
that show.
They really are.
Making multiple millions.
Really,
of dollars.
Multiple. Multiple millions. All right, the story you did today, it's fascinating to me. There's been a glut of commercial productions
yes.
that come through. Touring productions done really for for-profit
yes.
Theater coming through town. Chicago's not embracing them.
Well, it's been tough, Justin. These last few days and weeks, it's been tough. We've had a show called The Hell Drivers of Daytona that opened and closed pretty much on the same night. We've had Cheers the Musical, which I really liked, actually. Cheers the Musical was a fun show. That closed suddenly. I heard some story today that they'd literally said to the actors, goodbye, we'll send your stuff on after you. So, I mean, that was that bad. Those
wow.
guys thought they were all on a national tour for the next year, and it all just fell apart, which is a reminder of the fragility of the business they call show, let me tell you. So there was that didn't go well. There was this show, The Barty Bunch, which was kind of a mashup of the
yeah.
Brady Bunch and the part. That tanked. So there's been quite a few fairly high-profile snafus. The factors to me are, number one, well, the Cubs are in town. That's not, great for live entertainment, nor for restaurants, because you're looking now at the next 2.5 weeks, we like to think, of action, especially if those games go the full, you know, the full seven games. Yeah. That kills the next two. By then, it's almost the holidays. So your people are dealing with that. They're dealing with our good friend Donald Trump, who is more theatrical than anything in a theater, more outrageous, more, you know, this is like addictive.
Yeah.
I was sitting there as I was waiting for the gig tonight. I'm sitting there watching as I had a little roast chicken. I'm sitting there watching, you know, his wife demanding an apology. I'm like, what is she demanding an apology for?
She's demanding us.
A retraction? I don't know exactly what she was demanding. But you've got Donald Trump, who is an enormous entertaining distraction.
I mean, there's something to it. I remember when the Cubs went in 2003, the year with obviously with Bartman and the whole that there were a lot of stories that came out about how the Cubs and that whole movement crushed theater box offices. A lot of theaters in that area in Lakeview, they just... Audiences don't come out. That is just a thing that they don't when there's sporting events.
And it's worse when you're in Lakeview because people think you can't park. I mean, the Mercury Theater, I hear, has just been having people call up and they'll say, I can't park. Or they'll say, can I get my money back because there's a playoff game? So that's a big problem. And if you go back even further to the great days of Michael Jordan in the 90s, it used to cripple June in this town. You remember in June, everything used to stop. Nobody went out to eat.
Yeah.
Everybody, the only place that did well was sports bars. Now, I was talking to this a pal of mine who owns a restaurant out in Jefferson Park, and he was saying essentially that it's no good for restaurants, that people don't go to a bar, but that's it. And so that I do think that's a problem. I do think the election is a bit of a problem. But you've also got, you know, what Hamilton teaches us, I think, is that people want shows at the moment that are exciting and that are substantial. People are in a mood for some substance. You know, you watch the TV and you watch Trump and you go... The theater is more substantial. You know, I'm actually writing about this on Sunday, that you can go, if you've got kids and you want to teach your kids a bit about America, what democracy means, what America's all about, you know, to elevate the discourse, to get them to think about what it means to represent others and what leadership is. Hamilton's a lot better than the presidential campaign. I mean, good
it's
Lord.
True, it's true.
I mean, it's upside down. You know, the clowns are not in the theater, Justin. They're right there. You know, they're right there. I mean, everything's topsy-turvy.
Yeah.
So I'm like, go to Hamilton and switch off Donald Trump.
Is there anything to be – that? And we've talked about this on how, you know, theater has become an expensive ticket. And then these commercial productions come through town. They're not cheap. You're not $20.
No, I mean, they're 50, 60, 70, right. And I also – I think some of them – you know, there's a lot of retro shows. There's a lot of sitcoms. It's like the Cheers show, for example, was, you know, for any fan of Cheers, it was the first season of Cheers. And that was very good TV writing, I'm sure you recall. And it had actually had a good arc, as they say in dramatic structure terms, because you had the relationship between with Diane, and so you had that ability to sort of create an actual arc that their relationship could kind of span the whole show. And they were really good actors, good union actors, and it was a great show. But it was still Cheers, and you know, people, anybody under 40 now. They're like, really? I'm going to go, you know, and the same with the Brady Bunch. And I mean, yes, they're nostalgic attractions, but they're not, they don't compel you to go. That's the problem. They're not must-sees. And that's the thing that Hamilton has got. Everybody's, you know,
it's a must-see.
Killing them. It's a must-see. Otherwise, you feel like you are not on top of the, you know, the conversation in our town. You've got to see it. I mean, I got hit up 3 times today with people.
Really?
Three times. Yeah. Everyone's like...
Say, I'll get you Hamilton tickets if you can get me unrestricted views.
That's right. I'll even trade you. the two that I bought tonight. Did I mention they were 2 1/4?
Chris Jones, chief theater critic at the Chicago Tribune. We'll take a quick break. We'll come back, talk some more. Stay with us. I am not betting against my cuffs. I am not betting against my cuffs. Just like my city, the young, scrappy, and gritty. What is this? Oh, the Hamilton parodies coming out of the woodwork. Hamilton and Cubs. Perfect for Chris Jones. Yeah, there we go. Chicago Tribune's Chris Jones in studio. All right, so let's talk about a couple more issues. Obviously, War Paint was here during the summertime. It's great pre-Broadway tryout. And just today they said, hey, we know.
For the main stem, baby, the main stem, the Broadway opening in April. That's the Goodman Theater production going to Broadway with Patti LuPone, complete with her outrageous Polish accent, which I was about to attempt, but maybe not. And then Christine Ebersole playing the two makeup heiresses, Helena Rubinstein and Elizabeth Arden.
Is this the kind of thing, you know, that we'll see in June for the Tonys?
Oh yeah, I think you will absolutely Warpain see will two be, nominations. Yeah. I think that's the aim for two, you know, because it's sort of structured as a twin lead. I think Patti LuPone is an absolute certainty for a Tony nomination. Of course, I'm saying all this before the season's even barely got going, but it's a pretty good bet. And Kristin Ebersole too. How the show will do, that remains to be seen. My view is they need to do a lot of work. So the question will be, have they done that work? But the show sold in Chicago massively. I mean, the Goodman was getting Cubs prices, let me tell you, almost what I paid today for my precious restricted view tickets they were getting for Warpaint. And so it did very well. People, you know, it's interesting that people just want to see that show. You know, particularly a certain, let's say a certain, ladies of a certain age are very interested in it because those two women were exceedingly famous. And of course, were very influential on style and on makeup. So I think that's kind of cool news. The other good part of that is that a lot of Chicago performers get to do a Broadway show.
That's great.
There's several of them in it. Far as I can tell, everybody's going. They got a little iffy on that today. I'm like, is everybody going? Well, we think so.
So yeah, pay attention to that.
You know, not everything's signed, I guess. But I think pretty much it's the Goodman production that's going to Broadway. So that is an exciting thing. That's a big positive. It's always good when shows from here go to New York.
And the other story in Chicago that just hit the papers this week, and you wrote about it, was more administrative, and mostly because of a fallout at Second City.
Second City is a bizarre,
some cast members left.
Cast members, administrators, more staff changes. I heard there were a couple more today even. There's a lot of turmoil.
What's happening there?
Well, you know, it's hard to, as an outsider, it's hard to put your finger on it entirely. I think it's a combination of just really an older generation of creative leadership that really did sort of keep everybody safe over there, that's now either died or moved on. You've got people like Sheldon Patinkin, Joyce Sloan, even Kelly Leonard, who's now left the company. So you've got a bit of a vacuum of leadership, and there's been a lot of attempts to fill it, and I think they are still trying to get that sorted out. And then my suspicion is that the younger generation of performer is probably a little bit less tolerant than you were when you were 22 of the 10:30 Trump voting drunk Yahoo who's shouting stuff out at 10:30 at night. Maybe of
they
a
kind of pointed to
nature.
This. They alluded to this.
They
Andrew,
did.
Andrew
they
Alexander did. Alluded to the idea that there were. That the staff was uncomfortable with the concept of some of the stuff that was being thrown at them.
The crude things being thrown at them. If anyone listening has been to Second City 11 o'clock on a Saturday night, that is, you're going to get it. And it's not pleasant sometimes, but you're going to get it. And traditionally in improv, I'm telling you this, but traditionally you use that, you let it roll off your back. You know, I just wonder sometimes with a younger generation of performer now, and you can argue, rightly so, there's a less of a willingness to tolerate that kind of thing.
Especially,
and that's just a cultural change.
And you know, depending on what's being thrown out, but we are seeing a shift in sort of political correctness and what we're allowed to sort of laugh at, or we are supposed to just sort of roll off our backs. That it's changed. My generation, you just kind of went with it, and you could even match the dirtiness and things of that nature.
Yes,
that's not
that
that's not
no,
what
that's
they
right.
can do. They're not allowed to do that at
that's
Second
right.
City either.
That's right. And then on adding to that, you've got this sort of crude political discourse right now with the world of Trump and the world of, you know, grabbing this and that, and you've got all of that in the mainstream. So, you know, what Andrew, I think, was arguing was that people are feeling more empowered. A certain kind of person is feeling more empowered to shout some of that stuff out. And it's very tricky, and it requires a lot of experience to handle in a comedic sort of way, because it's just very, very difficult. And I think you've got younger performers, that's a very difficult. It's just Second City perhaps adjusting to the new world order.
It's amazing to think about, too, because you can go as far back as Bill Murray and guys like that, John Belushi, who were young, 19, 20, 21 years old, doing the same thing and dealing with the same shout-outs of their time and able to – that almost becomes a rites of passage. So there is something to be said that Second City is a training ground for – being able to handle that kind of stuff at a young age.
I'm guessing it was pretty difficult to offend John Belushi. Can you imagine John Belushi going out and going, I'm really offended by that remark from
maybe,
the audience.
Maybe,
like, he would have cared of what anybody ever said to him. It's
I'm fascinated.
How we've changed.
Next time you're on, we got to talk more about what you find out about that situation. Because I am interested if it's a generational thing.
Yes.
Or if, you know, it's just sort of dysfunction that's happening in Second City.
Well, I think it's a bit of both. And I think some of it's just change and the difficulty of change. And, you know, to their credit, they still sell out every night. if somebody's coming to town and they say, I'm going to, you know, I've never been to Chicago, I want to see one show, I always send them there. You can't go wrong. It's not, can't go wrong. It's proven material. It's not expensive. It's a good time. You know, both reviews there, when I saw them, I've actually just taken away my recommendation of one of them because everybody's left. So I'm not like recommending a show I've not seen with the people doing it. But I think in general, the shows have been pretty, you know, remain pretty solid.
And I think that that's something there. I mean, I think in the history of Second City, and, you know, you'd know better than I, but it does feel like rarely are there these mass exoduses.
Yes.
Most of the time they'll get picked off to either their time is up or they get picked off by a television show to go to L.A. or New York like Saturday Night Live. But the idea that a cast is like, I'm fed up with it. Three, four people left?
I mean, it's bizarre. And of course, they don't like to talk about it because nobody wants to be labeled a troublemaker.
Right.
So these are not always easy stories to report for that reason.
Interesting.
But, you know, they'll recover. It's not, you know, it's not going anywhere. It's not going anywhere. But it's still an interesting. I just think the world of improv and of tolerance and all of that is just changing greatly. And Andrew makes this argument that people are too crude, you know, that people feel empowered by what they're seeing on their TV sets right now.
And that may well be right. And it goes to both sides because you're also seeing a different generation, a different tolerance to people performing on stage together.
Improv
is very misogynistic in times when
guys,
and this has been highly documented in the theater community, where you're getting sexual harassment essentially on stage from guys who think it's funny.
Yes.
And that is something that has to change. And it seems like it might be changing. We see, you know, we saw at I.O. An actual, almost like a Bill of Rights, things
yes.
like that coming through.
No, I think that's all good stuff, and it's all changes that have to happen, but it's not easy for it to happen.
Chris Jones, always a pleasure, man.
My pleasure, man.
I'm sorry that you didn't have a show. Usually I piggyback on it, so I apologize to your family.
Right.
You know,
just cost me $500 tonight.
Exactly. My bad. Just charge it to the download. We're friends. We're friends at Wrigley. Good to see you, buddy. All right. Let's get an update on who the Cubs are going to be playing. Game's not over, but it's exciting.
It is.
Of course.
Yeah, we'll talk about it in sports, but Justin, the Nationals have clawed their way back into this game.
Whoa.
The Dodgers now lead 4-3.
4-3. If I can editorialize, I'd much rather have the Nationals than the Dodgers. Not because I care about anything but the storylines. And the two storylines that I love, Dusty Baker. How great would it be to excise that demon, right? To say, like, you know, to on the way to the World Series to beat the old coach who couldn't get it done. And then also, I didn't even realize this. Pete mentioned it in the break that Daniel Murphy, the guy who killed the Cubs last year, he's on the Nationals now.
Yeah.
He's their MVP. That would be great. Again, you got to go through, right? You got to go. Yeah, I don't like the kind of swerving around.
Well, Murphy's like, 1-for-2 for the Nationals tonight.
Yeah, he ain't nothing.
Nothing.
He ain't nothing.
So Pete's going to have to backstop me on this one, but it was 3-3 the series this year. I think what it was 2-1 for the Dodgers in L.A. and then 2-1 for the Cubs here. Does that sound about right for the season series?
In terms of the Cubs and the Dodgers?
Yeah.
I'll check that for you. I don't know, but I know that again, I'm an outsider. I love the Cubs are winning, but as a non-Cubs fan, neither of these teams... The Nationals or the Dodgers are close to what the Cubs are. Sorry, they're not. I don't know if I've told you this, Rob, but I am a avid fantasy baseball player champion, 3-time champion in the last 5 years.
I've heard that.
Yeah, I just want to put it down, but that's sort of where it's at. And I'm familiar with both of these lineups in there. Come on. It ain't nothing.
No.
It ain't nothing. I don't even know why we're talking about it.
In fact, what I think the Cubs will do is probably let whatever team they face Saturday night out to probably like a 4 or 5 run lead.
I was going to say.
And then just reel them back in.
One hand behind their back. That's what I'm talking about. Get like a 7, go down 7-0 in the third and still beat them.
Yeah.
I saw somebody tweet that if the Nationals lose, he can't wait for Dusty Baker's 17-year-old son Darren to sit on his lap in the post-game press conference. I remember he did that thing.
Or run out to get that bat that's lying in the batter's box and have some guy run out just to save his life before
he
gets 17? Run over.
Oh,
is that how long ago? Wow,
man. That's awesome.
Because he was four or five?
Yeah, when he did that was even the year before he came to Chicago, right? That was when he was with the Giants when he was a little 4-year-old?
It's like 2002 World Series, I think.
Wow. There you go. There's probably an easy math equation in there, but I'm not going to do it. No, I can't do it. I don't have time. Uh-uh. Welcome back to Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Coffin. Well, this Friday night is the return of my favorite local program. Check Please, the Dining Restaurant Recommendation Roundtable television program, is in its 16th season. The show, produced by David Manilow, airs on Channel 11 here in Chicago. The host, Catherine DiOrio, is embarking on her fourth season, and she joins us tonight to talk about what we can expect from the new season of Check Please. Catherine, thanks for being here. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me, Justin.
All right. So for you, I mean, this is your fourth season. How are you? Are you more comfortable as the host of this program now, sort of trying to bring out the stories of strangers and their food?
Yeah, you know, I think you definitely, I think like anybody, you become more comfortable the longer you're in that seat at the head of the table. but you know, it's interesting. You kind of find your own style. And also you kind of learn what works and doesn't work. So it's a little bit of trial and error, I think, those first seasons. And now I think I get a lot more information and I'm a lot more willing to call guests out because, you know, well, because sometimes, you know, they'll tell me one thing. They'll say, oh, I hate that restaurant or I really didn't like it. And then you get on set and they feel really bad. They don't want to say they didn't enjoy something because they've been like having wine with one of the other guests before the show. And so now I feel more comfortable being like, I don't think that was really your opinion.
Right.
And, you know, so it's a bit interesting. So it was a learning process for me, and you know, and I think that it makes me a stronger host now, feeling more comfortable there, because obviously as a viewer, you know, you want an honest opinion, and if I let everybody just say, oh, everything's great, when that's not really how they felt, that doesn't help anybody.
Oh, and that's the beauty of the show too, the ability for people to have conflict. How many times do you have to deal with the fact that somebody comes in and is very stark in their opinion when they get to set? They're like, oh, it's okay, it's all right, I'll just be milk toast.
You know, it's funny, people have pretty strong opinions about food. And I think the Check Please guests in particular do. I think that sometimes there's an intimidation factor just because I think that when you work in front of cameras, you forget that it can be a little intimidating walking in, sitting down on a set. We're like, oh, ignore everything that's going around as like 10 people are around you. There's lights shining in your face. You know, you're sweating. And you're just kind of not sure what's happening. And so I think that sometimes is what where they feel a little bit intimidated at first. And I think that's a huge part of my job, is making sure that they don't feel intimidated so we can get their good opinions. And, you know, so it happens. But I think that David and Jackie, the producers, you know, the David Manilow, obviously, who created the show, and then Jackie, who's one of our amazing producers, they do a really great job of vetting the guests, and they luckily keep me out of that process.
Well, you know what I love about Check Please is just through the course of putting together all the episodes and actually, you know, discussing the restaurants that are on the show that the guests bring to the show, it becomes almost the annual, almost like the state of the food industry or the culinary industry here in Chicago, because you see what the trends are. You understand more about what people are talking about when it comes to restaurant. Do you agree with that? I mean, do you pick up on sort of where we are as a city based on doing these shows?
Oh, yeah, for sure. You know, the one thing, though, I do have to say, and I think is one of the things that I loved about Check Please before I was a part of the show and love so much as part of the show, is that I think – yes, you see what's going on, and I think that definitely you'll see the trends, but I love that Check Please doesn't follow the trends. Mm-hmm. It's not, oh, you know, a lot of shows, a lot of times, just in media in general, you know, media will beget media, and so it's like, oh, everyone's writing about that restaurant, so now we have to write about it, or now we have to feature it. And I love that Check Please says no. Like, is, you know, what are our guests talking about? What are the people of Chicago talking about that don't care about trends, that just care about finding like that hidden gem, you know, great food? And so I think what really makes Check Please stand out in now a field saturated, you know, there's just so much food programming and so much food media, is that, yes, we obviously touch on the trends because, you know, you definitely have guests that are into what the new restaurant is and what the current trends are, and that's something they're interested in. but we don't, we're not slaves to the trends. Mm-hmm. And I think, so I feel like Checkley's gives a more complete picture of at least the Chicago dining scene.
For you, I mean, when we talk about trends, I mean, you're able to put three strangers together and talk about what's happening, you know, on each respective restaurant. But out of that come themes. Out of that comes service, the actual food, what kind of food people are preparing. Talk about, you know, as you've already sort of, you know, taped the episodes for the new season, are there threads like that that sort of you learn about the city of Chicago that maybe we need to do a better job with potatoes or maybe we have to talk about
it? I don't know how you can mess up potatoes. I mean, just put some butter and salt in there and they're great, you know. But yes, and I have to say that one of the trends, I started to see it last year, really, really saw it this year, is service. And it's interesting because I heard a lot of that from my guests. So the food was great. The, you know, design of the restaurant was top notch. I liked the vibe, but man, the service, wah-wah, you know? And on the flip side, what I hear from a lot of, you know, friends and colleagues in the industry is, man, it's really hard to find good servers out there now. And it's hard to find good front of the house people. So it's interesting, like, I'm hearing that from the people who are hiring, trying to hire good service, and they're, you know, all kind of competing for the best servers out there. And on the flip side, you know, I'm hearing, yeah, there's not that, you know, it's, there's a shortage of good servers.
For you, for you, how much are you, you know, you get the slate of people that are coming in and Jackie and David will go get the panelists. How much are you doing to prepare about each restaurant? I mean, how important is it for you to know if somebody says, I picked this great place on the west side? I mean, are you the kind of host that's like, okay, I need to know everything about this restaurant before going? Or are you the kind of host that's like, okay, well, you know, like, I'm going to be organic and let it come to me?
I am a researcher by nature. I'm very curious. You know, I was a litigator in my former life. I don't like not having the answer to the question. So if I don't know something, I go and look it up. I do interviews with the chefs, with the restaurateurs, and or the beverage director, depending on, you know, what the focus is. And I go to all of the restaurants. Wow. So I have an experience myself with that. Yes, my jeans don't like me by the end of the season. We're just starting to become friends again now that I've had a few weeks off from shooting.
Well, how does, I mean, for you guys at Checkpoint, how does it work? I mean, do you guys shoot all the stuff in advance? I mean, it's a pretty small series, you know, it's not like you're doing months at a time. I don't know how many episodes there actually are, but I mean, is it the kind of thing where you already know, I mean, you guys have already recorded things and get it slated up before you actually start airing the season on Channel 11?
Yeah, so we shoot everything. It's kind of fast and furious. We shoot all summer into early fall. And then for me, I get to finish up. Sometimes there's obviously some post-production work that has to happen, but then it kind of, you know, the editors take it from there. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, there's some stuff that still happens throughout the year. But as far as the in-studio shooting, that all happens during the summer months into, like I said, early fall.
Well, we know
it a little later than usual.
The website, if you go to Checkley's website on WTTW.com, you can see who the upcoming restaurants are. Can you give us an indication of what restaurants you might be doing later in the season?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, and it's, again, this very, you know, diverse group of restaurants. And so, you know, we went out to Mount Prospect, did Izakaya Thank You. Mm-hmm. So very traditional Japanese style Izakaya. But then also something that you just kind of already feel as a Chicago classic, like Chicago Cut. It's almost hard to believe it hasn't been on Check Please already, right. You know? So, and then kind of the new, you know, up and comers, Pub Royale is going to be on. And as you might know, it was actually, after we already shot it, it then was nominated as one of the 50 best restaurants by Bon Appetit.
Yeah.
And then, you know, Chicago Curry House. It's one of the few restaurants in Chicago that specializes in Nepalese cuisine. So it's kind of that real, true kind of Check Please mix of places from all over, you know, the suburbs, downtown, high, low, casual mom and pop to kind of, you know, big, splashier restaurants.
Well, the dramas, the comedies, the HBO fair, it'll all start and it'll all go away. But for me, right now, the best bet that's on TV, and it's I'm so happy to have it back, is Check Please. It starts tomorrow night on WTTW Channel 11. Catherine DiOrio is the host of Check Please. Catherine, so great to talk to you, and we got to get you in studio so we can talk more about Check Please.
Yes, I would love that. Or we'll go and have dinner and... we can talk about that.
Yeah, that's good. I think that could work, too.
That sounds better, right? Getting out of the studio.
It does. Thanks, Catherine.
Thanks so much. Let's have a great night.
We're off tonight, or off tomorrow night. We were off tonight. It was an off night. No, I thought it was a great show tonight. It's a lot of fun. Tomorrow night we're off. The Blackhawks go to Nashville. Oh, God. I love that town. Hate that hockey team. Someone has to, right? Like, I really truly feel like if I can generate enough, you know, seethe, if that's a word, seethe for the Nashville Predators, maybe they can become a new rival since we play them so much, you know? Right now it's St. Louis Blues, obviously, but Nashville Predators. Come on. The yellow. That's tomorrow night. I think the game starts 7:30. Could be wrong on that, but we'll check. I'm dealing with, Pete? You'll love this. Today, it looks like I got a package stolen off my porch.
Oof.
Mm-hmm.
Something.
It's one of those things. Yeah, it was a blazer for my son. We have a wedding we have to go to, so it was like a blazer. And... my wife told me that when she came home, the gate was open, and she was like, something's amiss. And then she checked the UPS tracker, and it was delivered at 3, you know.
Mm.
And it's funny because she's mad. She's livid. She's like, you know, she feels almost like violated.
Yeah.
Where I'm like,
her house has been robbed.
Yeah, I do not feel that way. I'm like, call UPS or call or call Amazon or wherever it comes from, and they'll just send another one. Like, I don't feel at all because of the way that shipping is, internet shipping at this point. Like, you know, I don't feel any connection to the product. You know, like, maybe it's because I didn't actually purchase it. I don't, you know.
I mean, I live in a kind of a bigger courtyard building, and I see the UPS guy and the whatever delivery service, and I see them, like, just throw boxes over the, you know, over the gate. And I always wonder, I'm like, oh. Somebody's gonna take that, you know. Like, so it just seems to be some goofball. Like, I would try to, you know, console your wife.
Yeah,
and say,
I will.
Just like
I know, and I get it. And it's not the first time. I feel like I think it was over the summertime. There was another one that was like, and the joke. I mean, I think the last one was like party favors.
Yeah, you know? Like, what are like, they doing with this stuff?
That, like, the box was ripped open and like thrown on the street, and they just took the party favors. It was like party favors for like a birthday party, like, you know, like.
Yeah,
I don't even know, like, you know, balloons and stuff like that.
So this is the you're being
second
targeted.
Time. Yeah, it could be. The best part, though, you know what I'll do? I'll just case the neighborhood, and whoever's wearing like a little blazer and trying to pull it off, you know, like a teensy blazer,
like a grown man,
right? Walking down the street, thinking it's cool, like he's got good look, then I'll know it's him, right? Or maybe I'll go to the school and I'll be like, "Who's wearing a blazer to school today?" No, I get it, but it's also the price I pay to live in the city.
Yeah.
And I don't mean that as like, oh, I'm okay with crime, because it's just crime to steal someone else's property.
Yeah.
But I also know that it's not my first rodeo, meaning I've lived in city apartments throughout my life, and there have been other cases where this has happened to me. So
you need to get a video camera.
Yeah, that's what I need
put
to
put it
do.
Out there.
Because
you see that every Christmas. Like, look at this monster taking away this package on my front porch.
Yeah, I'm going to invest in a whole new system for the house.
And $45,000 on a security system for a $25 blazer seems about right.
$25? Try $39.
Oh, sorry.
All right, Patty Vasquez up next. Pretty late with Patty Vasquez. This is Chicago's very own 720 WGN Chicago, WGNRadio.com. I'm Justin Kaufman. Be back on Monday.